do have forms for each side. So, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Podolsky. Well, our first item is we have a series of informational meetings, and the first item is a report of the Oregon Youth Authority relating to the River Bend Detention Center in La Grande, Oregon. I'd like to call up Bob Jester and Phil Lemon to present on this subject.
Is this the same one you had on the left?
Yeah. This is updated. And committee, this part of the program was convened at the request of the House and Senate leadership because of some public reports about issues that had arisen at the La Grande Detention Center. And we want to try to make sure we get the fullest information out on this subject, and so I was going to encourage people, if you have questions as we go along, I think Mr. Jester and Mr. Lennon could entertain those as we proceed, so we make sure that we get the fullest kind of development of the information about what happened. So feel free to break in if there are questions you would like to have answered. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Jester. I am the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and with me this morning is Deputy Director Phil Lemon. And we're here at the request of the committee to discuss allegations of misconduct at Riverbend Youth Transitional Program. I believe you have copies of my written testimony. We appreciate the opportunity to provide you with information. We will be going through a series of materials on the subject matter, and I would absolutely welcome questions or opportunities to provide you clarification. First, I would like to communicate with you five themes that I think are very important for the conversation we're undertaking this morning. First, the Oregon Youth Authority and myself as a director take allegations of misconduct very seriously. This body, last legislative session, funded the Office of Professional Standards at the Oregon Youth Authority. You may recall that we were the only public safety agency that did not have an internal affairs capacity. That was brought up during the Michael Boyles hearings, and this body funded one internal investigator and one support staff. I would like to say that that office did a yeoman's job with this set of issues. We also have developed the Oregon Youth Authority principles of conduct, which are very specific in terms of pointing out to all of our staff, management, represented folks alike, along with our partners and stakeholders, a zero tolerance for any kind of not reporting of misconduct by staff, that we do not accept nor will we allow a code of silence to exist in our facilities. Second, I think it's important, and as we have met with individual members, it has been clear that folks were not aware that all of the allegations that are currently under investigation by the Oregon State Police and are in the legal system were allegations that were brought forward by the Oregon Youth Authority. That our Office of Professional Standards investigated the situation at Riverbend, and that produced all of the allegations that were then sent to Oregon State Police and the Secretary of State's office. I would like to comment the Secretary of State's office has reviewed our internal documents. They have looked at the allegations. They have looked at the system improvement plan recommendations, and they have communicated back to us in writing that they find that the action on the part of the Youth Authority was more than sufficient to meet the threshold of accountability for oversight and control, and that they would see no further need at this point to involve themselves in additional review of the situation at River Bend. Third, we held staff accountable.
Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jester, You're saying that the allegations of misconduct were produced by the agency's own internal review. I appreciate that. Did they discover this misconduct originally, or will somebody tell you that this misconduct was occurring?
Senator Whitsitt, the origin of the complaint was in fact a grievance by a staff member at Riverbend over a salary issue. And after the staff member filed that grievance, there was a concern that was expressed by staff over the staff's individual safety, in that staff were communicating, you know, that the director could be a bully and had a relative in prison, and that I sure wouldn't come forward with a grievance. We pursued that grievance through the Office of Professional Standards along with our human resources folks, and through the course of interviewing with that individual staff, the disclosure of the allegations of misconduct, which would be law violations if found true, were then uncovered.
Thank you.
At the time they were uncovered, they were forwarded to the Oregon State Police for investigation. We have held staff accountable where we have evidence to do so. We feel that it is very important to separate those staff who are not meeting expectations on their job, who are not living up to the code of ethics, who are not following OARs, from the vast majority of our staff who do an excellent job, who put in 110% every day, come to work, and truly are dedicated public servants and produce results and outcomes that I am, as a director of a state agency, proud to come before you, our board of directors, every biennium and report the outcome of the efforts of our staff. So we have held staff accountable where there's evidence to do so. Fourth, there are areas that we absolutely can do a better job. We are working both through policies and procedures to vigorously address those and implement changes in our oversight and control of the Oregon Youth Authority to minimize the likelihood that this series of events which we have uncovered could occur in another facility or in the future. Lastly, I appreciate the time the members have given us to discuss this issue, and I want to make certain that we're addressing any of the concerns that you have regarding Riverbend. I would like to start by just giving a very brief history of what Riverbend is. In 1979, the legislature approved funding for the construction of a 25-bed work-study camp in Hilgard, Oregon, which is just west of LaGrande, just outside of LaGrande in Union County. This 25-bed work-study program was based on a model where half the youth in the facility were attending school, the other half in the facility were working on parks crew, and every week those two halves changed. So every other week you were working, learning vocational skills, learning work skills, and every other week you were in school completing your education. That program continued until the year 2000, when the state of Oregon applied for and received federal funding to build a youth boot camp. And you may recall that there was a period of time when federal money was available to states to expand their capacity. The hook was that you needed to build boot camps, and the state of Oregon built two. We built one in Tillamook, and we built one at the Camp Hilgard site. Upon completion of that program, we directed it more toward alcohol and drug treatment and vocational skills than what you would consider to be a traditional boot camp. That raised the capacity to 50, and it currently is a 50-bed facility. It is secure, perimeter fence, and has a very good standing in the community, both with the Parks Department, who Mr. Lemon and I have recently met with to renew our commitment to providing work crews to that organization. During the summer, the youth are also involved with ODOT doing highway crew, and we do a number of community service work crews for the County of Union. The other thing I'd like to talk about is the recruitment process that was used to fill the vacancy at McLaren. There has been questions about how did Mr. Humphreys, as this bad actor, alleged bad actor at Hilgard, end up kind of running the flagship in the Oregon Youth Authority system. First, let me explain to you that recruitments are done based on position descriptions. So we take a position description for the position at McLaren in this case. It's given to DAS. They put together a recruitment announcement based on what it is that the position requires. This was an open, competitive recruitment, which meant that not only did it target people within the Oregon Youth Authority, it targeted people within the state of Oregon and targeted people nationally. It is posted, was posted on the DAS website, posted on the Oregon Youth Authority website, posted on the Oregon Jobs Work site, as well as we do targeted newspaper advertising locally and nationally. We then receive a certified list from DAS of eligible candidates. So the list that we get of names and contact information are candidates that have met the threshold of the minimum qualifications for this position. There was an interview committee that interviewed, I believe, 8 or 9 candidates. 3 finalists were forwarded to the deputy and myself for final interviews and decision making. All 3 of those candidates happen to have been managers within our close custody system and had experience in running facility programs. The approach that we use in the final interview process is to match the skill set of a candidate with the needs of the position that we are recruiting and filling. Everyone is aware of Senate Bill 267, which requires that we reach a 75% threshold of providing evidence-based programming within the Oregon Youth Authority. We have exceeded that, and in part we have exceeded that because we have used the University of Cincinnati and Dr. Latessa to come out and train staff on best practices in facilities working with delinquent youth. And it is all based on cognitive behavioral therapy, EBT. And in the EBT training, we had a star that rose, and the star that rose was Mr. Humphreys. And Mr. Humphreys demonstrated a skill in both working with staff and other facilities, as well as working with youth and conducting groups. When Dr. Latessa and University of Cincinnati came out to train the Oregon both Adult Corrections and Youth Authority, and we have our juvenile department partners that participate in the correctional program checklist review process of our programs to determine whether they meet the threshold of evidence-based programming, it was clear that, you know, Mr. Humphreys' program and all the other programs in close custody, by the way, did not pass, were found to be ineffective. So we were not using best practices anywhere on the first round. The second round, which was done a year later, Riverbend, which is a program that Mr. Humphreys was responsible for, went from ineffective to highly effective. It went from a score in the low 40s to a score in the mid 70s. And that is an impressive accomplishment for a 12-month period of time. And this is done by a group of individuals, not Oregon Youth Authority staff, not staff that are on site, that could have been intimidated, bullied, and or results changed. This is a group of individuals, Oregon Youth Authority, folks from University of Cincinnati, Department of Corrections, potentially youth, juvenile department members as well. So we believe those results to be credible, and we believe that it demonstrated not only a willingness but a talent on his part. We then used him as a trainer statewide and had him go from Riverbend to visit our other close custody programs and do team training at the individual unit level where we were housing offenders in groups of 25. So Mr. Humphreys would work with teams of group life coordinators and teach them the skills of evidence-based practice, and in this case, the cognitive behavioral therapy. The reviews, which we give staff all feedback forms when we train them, were, you know, were very positive. and staff felt that he was credible, felt that he had been there, done that, had been a 20-year employee, had demonstrated a gift, if you will, for this work. Based on the above, he was promoted to the position of Superintendent McLaren. He was at the time a 20-year employee.
Thank you, Chair McPherson Przanski. My reflection on hiring process is a question about the, I don't think anybody questions the validity of his skills in cognitive behavior therapy, but being a previous middle school principal, I needed to know about curriculum, I need to know about teaching, but I also need to know about management. Was there some sort of scale, or how were management skills assessed in this interview process?
Co-chairs and Representative Comp, I appreciate that question, because the measurable outcomes that we use for looking at our programs in terms of fiscal responsibility, fiscal management, when we look at numbers of grievances, turnover, we had not had complaints from Riverbend staff. The indicators that we use to measure outcome, particularly in the budget area, you know, all lined up for Mr. Humphreys. And actually, I have mentioned to some of you individually and certainly to those that I report to, this was really a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of situation for us. We were providing the oversight to Dr. Jekyll, and in fact it was Mr. Hyde that was doing these allegations of law violations while he was out at Riverbend. But the Dr. Jekyll was certainly producing results that were all on the positive side of the scale.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Jester, there's a couple of other things that I think we talked about when we met earlier. One was the apparent lack of supervision in that if I recall correctly, the Eastern Oregon manager position was vacant. So I think Mr. Lehman called that the circuit rider who would just appear from time to time and check things out. And during this period of time, you didn't have someone doing that. So that when you did arrive, it came with when you came to one of these facilities to inspect it, it came with an appointment and an entourage, and you just didn't have. And the other thing that you, as I recall, that you didn't have staffed at the time was appropriate internal auditing. Can you discuss why that occurred?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I appreciate the comments and the question. When the then Attorney General, now Governor, headed the Juvenile Justice Task Force on Reform in the mid-90s, the recommendation coming out from a year-long process involving practically 600 stakeholders and partners in the public safety arena across the state was that the juvenile justice system be organized regionally, and that the regional organization of the system be used to leverage state resources at the local level, recognizing that there are distinct differences between parts of the state of Oregon. What works in central eastern Oregon is not necessarily what would work or what would be needed in the metropolitan area, and may in fact be far different than what would work on the southern Oregon coast or the southern valley. So we were organized into five regions where we had a regional administrator that was housed in that region. And the responsibility of that position was that they provided oversight for both the field, the facility that they had or facilities that they had in their region, as well as working very closely with our contract providers. They met with local public safety coordinating councils. They met with local county commissioners. They met with judges. They listened to what the public's perception was of what was needed, and then they leveraged the state resources to try to fill the gaps at the local level. In the budget reductions during the 2001-03 legislative session, those positions were part of our budget reduction plan that we, you recall, closed 250 close custody capacity beds. We closed a number of private provider beds, and we felt that it was incumbent upon the agency to look at our administrative structure and streamline that as well. So those five positions went away. We became a centralized organization. We have one individual that is responsible for the oversight of our 11 facilities across the state, and we have one person who is responsible for our 11 parole and probation offices, that cover the 36 counties. The ability of those individuals to establish and maintain close working relationships both with the community as well as the individual facilities is somewhat limited by the scope of their responsibilities. In the case of the facilities, our facilities assistant administrator would set appointments to go out to facilities, particularly distance facilities. And Riverbend being, 6 hours from Salem, it was important for him to contact facility to say, I'm planning to be out there next Tuesday and Wednesday. He would like to see this, this, and this. Go out on a work crew, talk with the Parks Department, like to meet with the county chair, etc. Appointments would be set up. That individual would travel out, would accomplish that mission, come back. There was few, if ever, random unannounced visits to those facilities based on our current structure and organization. One of the recommendations that you'll hear from Mr. Lemon as he talks about the system improvement plan is that we begin doing that by using additional administrative staff from the Oregon Youth Authority, not relying on one person that's responsible for facilities, but that we share that responsibility and that we broaden the bench of people that will be making those kinds of visits. Our internal auditor, it has been a struggle that you may or may not be aware of in the state of Oregon to hire internal auditors. I believe that there are four current recruitments for internal auditors from four agencies. We have all been unsuccessful in our last round. I think that the last agency to pick one up was the Oregon State Police, but it is a position that's hard to fill. And it's hard to fill for a couple reasons. One is we're a single internal auditor shop, which means that you have one person that works solo and doesn't have a team or a group with which to plan and share the workload with and collaborate professionally. The second is that DAS is currently involved in looking at the compensation package for that position to make sure that it's in sync with recruitment and retention. But that position continues to be vacant in the Oregon Youth Authority.
Senator Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want me to... thank you, Mr. Jester, for being here this morning. Have we ever looked at external auditors contracting this out?
Representative Cameron, we have not, but that's an excellent suggestion.
Shields, we're followed.
If I may, before...
Okay, go ahead.
Is there any obstacles stopping us, statutes or anything stopping us from tomorrow from going out and contracting with an external audit firm to come in and, say, audit us?
Co-chairs and Representative Cameron, we will certainly explore that. Offhand, I would say that I'm not aware of one. If it were a represented position, there would be a barrier to contracting out, as we must do a feasibility study per the contracts that we currently have with both AFSCME and SEIU. The internal audit position, however, is a management service position and not represented. So that is an excellent suggestion and one that we will absolutely follow up with.
So Shields, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jester, I just thought of this question. Is there a particular brand of cognitive behavioral therapy that you're using, like neural recognition therapy, which we've heard of before, or is it just kind of a more generic therapeutic intervention that staff has developed?
co-chairs, Representative Shields, I am more familiar with the therapy that we're currently using in the young women's facility than I am with the cognitive behavioral intervention therapy that we have trained staff to, which I do know is not as sophisticated as a training that we are currently using in Oak Creek.
And
but we'll get you to answer that question.
Thank you, Kim. Ask a follow-up or two. I guess my comment would be that you might want to question the merits of cognitive behavioral therapy that would allow such dissonance between the facilitator's talk and their actions. And I mean, in my experience in working with criminals is that they love to point out inconsistencies in the facilitator's behavior because then they can justify their own criminal behavior more easily. And so one of the questions that I had based on that is, were there any, I know that you've instigated an 800 number for the family members of kids and the kids themselves perhaps to even complain to. Was there any change in or complaints that were driven from the outside, from the family members or the kids, that might have tipped this off?
Co-chairs and Representative Shields, I mean, that's an excellent question. And our Office of Professional Standards has done a couple things. Number one, we have created a 1-800 number that is accessible to all of our youth. We use the same policy that governs access to legal counsel, which means that once that request is made, it must be facilitated within a reasonable period of time the same day. And, I mean, if we're in the middle of doing something and a youth wants to contact Professional Standards, there is a policy that makes that happen within a set period of hours if they have that telephone private conversation with PSO. We have been involved in a national project of performance-based standards, which is out of the Council of Juvenile Corrections Administrators, and that project does a series of surveys, and it surveys both youth offenders and facilities, it surveys their families, it surveys at the point of exit, and those surveys have been normed, and actually Riverbend, you know, shows well in that array, as well as the fact that we have not had individual clients step forward and say, you know, this is wrong. And I think the reason that we have not had that happen at Riverbend, and we didn't have that happen at Riverbend, and it didn't show up on the surveys, is I don't believe that the youth offenders that are in that program had a clue that these things were going on. I don't believe that when the allegations were happening that the youth offenders knew that Mr. Humphreys had direct involvement and or that those projects were not prior approved. So I don't believe that there was a dissonance between the cognitive behavioral therapy and, you know, pointing out what you're absolutely right, youth offenders are the first to come forward and say, you know, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so did this wrong. And we get a lot of that coming into PSO. We get a lot of that in surveys. We get a lot of that from families which come into our facilities and say, this didn't seem right. I was treated poorly. So that was not a spike in Riverbend.
Okay. Just before we go on, we've got 16 minutes for this presentation before, so I want to make certain that we're on the issues that are before us. I want to make sure they have a chance to get the information out to us. We can follow up on our own, and if we need to bring them back for a full meeting, we'll do that. So, Mr. Jester, I'd like for you to go forward, and I do just want to put on the record, as Representative Cameron said about the auditor positions, one thing I think we would need to look at is what the authority is within the Secretary of State's office, because they are charged to do audits of agencies. And maybe something that would have a conflict for something external and going out and hiring, but at the same time, we may want to look at what they're doing in some way that we could have a universal auditing unit that I would assume is what Secretary of State's already working with, that would be designated for these type of reviews.
Chair Przanski, comment on that. You're absolutely right that Secretary of State's office and the Audits Division is actively involved in auditing the Youth Authority and all other state agencies. They do financial audits, they do performance audits, they do timekeeping audits, overtime audits. All those have been accomplished in the Youth Authority, JGIS audits. This is something over and above where you have an internal auditor and the ability to go out and really look thoroughly at a program. and I think the Secretary of State's office was stretched. A spike in Riverbend.
Okay. Hey, just before we go on, we've got 16 minutes for this presentation before, so what I want to make certain is that we're on issues that are before us. I want to make sure they have a chance to get the information out to us. We can follow up on our own, and if we need to bring them back for a full meeting, we'll do that. So, Mr. Jester, I'd like for you to go forward, and I do just want to put on the record, as as Representative Cameron said about the auditor positions, one thing I think we would need to look at is what the authority is within the Secretary of State's office, because they are charged to do audits of agencies. And maybe something that would have a conflict for something external and going out and hiring, but at the same time, we may want to look at what they're doing in some way that we could have a universal auditing unit that I would assume is what Secretary of State's already working with, that would be designated for these type of reviews.
Chair Przanski, comment on that. You're absolutely right that Secretary of State's office and the Audits Division is actively involved in auditing the Youth Authority and all other state agencies. They do financial audits, they do performance audits, they do timekeeping audits, overtime audits. All those have been accomplished at the Youth Authority, JGIS audits. This is something over and above where you have an internal auditor and the ability to go out and really look thoroughly at a program. And I think the Secretary of State's office was stretched to the point that internal audit to supplement and augment that made sense. I'd like to take the opportunity to go through a timeline to point out when these events occurred and what actions the Oregon Youth Authority took in response to them. The information that first came to the Oregon Youth Authority, which actually came through the Department of Corrections Internal Affairs Office, was April 16th of 2007. So over a year ago, we got the initial complaint that one of the staff at Riverbend felt intimidated by her supervisor, and that later became matched with a grievance, and the two became one. We, Professional Standards Office, went out, interviewed the individual that had filed the wage grievance, and that staff provided three allegations to Professional Standards Office. One, that an entrance sign had been contracted for by a private party using a purchase order procedure with the state of Oregon, that if it's under $5,000, there are certain signature authorities, and that includes our superintendents and camp directors. The amount was $4,999. That contract was let, and the allegation was that youth actually made the sign, the contractor did not, and there was a suspicion that there had been a financial kickback to the director. The second allegation was that the shop class in the school had made cabinets out of wood that was left over from a project with the parks, where we made a set of cabinets for a parks building in Union County, and that those cabinets were later installed in Mr. Humphrey's kitchen by a youth work crew. The third allegation was that roofing, which was not consistent with the roofing that is on the buildings at Camp Togard River Bend, was purchased with state funds for allegedly a project that was going to occur in re-roofing a barn using a youth work crew for money to pay restitution. That opportunity did not materialize. Some 2 years later, when the roofing had been at the camp sitting, the roofing was in fact installed in Mr. Humphrey's private residence using a youth work crew. Those were the three initial allegations that were brought forward. Those were turned over the same day to the Oregon State Police. Oregon State Police asked that we not talk to Mr. Humphreys about these allegations. He's now at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. He's been there for 2 months. He's not at he is at McLaren. I'm sorry. He is at McLaren, been there for 2 months, and they asked that we not talk to him until they had the opportunity to do an interview. In May, the state police interviewed Mr. Humphreys. They gave us information that indicates that the roofing piece, at least, is likely to be true. We place him on administrative leave, and he resigns his position. After consulting with the Oregon State Police, that we did not want to get sideways with their investigation of the other two law violations in addition to the roof, I asked our professional standards office to conduct a thorough review of Riverbend, using our accounting manager, our HR manager, our then internal auditor, and any other staff that he felt were needed from either inside or outside the agency to make certain that we had a good grasp on the events that were coming to light at Riverbend. That process began in June and ran through August. The team made multiple visits to Riverbend, multiple staff interviews, and an inspection of a myriad of records, from cell phone to payroll to purchasing to hiring. I mean, they went through everything that we had documents on for Riverbend. In September, the Riverbend review team issued 26 recommendations to improve the oversight and controls over our facilities and our offices within the Youth Authority. At that time, we also dismissed the remaining two managers at Riverbend, and we went through a process and dismissed two represented staff. And these four individuals, we believe to have the greatest involvement and knowledge about the wrongdoing at Riverbend. They were dismissed. We have since brought one of the represented staff back through a mediation process, and with lesser discipline than termination, in that it was believed, as we uncovered additional information about Mr. Humphreys being a bully boss, that it was unreasonable to expect that these individuals would perhaps come forward with concerns and allegations about their supervisor. He was returned with lesser discipline. The second represented staff is still out, and we are currently, through labor relations, negotiating a settlement on that individual, which will include discipline as well. In October, the agency issued through our business services office an RFP, a request for a proposal, for a contractor to lead a system improvement plan process, which would engage both management and labor folks to look at the 26 recommendations and come up with an implementation plan. We selected Bob Mink, who was a respondent to that RFP. Again, it was a competitive open process. He signed on effective the 1st of January, and that process began. You may remember that he's the former director of the Department of Human Resources and has a vast knowledge in state systems and how they work from being in a variety of state agencies. In May, the work groups concluded their work, and the draft system improvement plan was issued to all agency staff for their review and recommendations. And in June this month, the report is finalized, and the agency is moving forward to implement the recommendations within 90 days.
Question, Senator Wissett, you had a question that you, I think, wanted to pose.
Yes, Mr. Jester, thank you. Mr. Jester, I believe you stated that the youth at Riverbend had no idea that their work that they performed was not authorized. Were the youth paid for the work that was performed on the roof and the cabinet in the private residence?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wisnett, we have actually, from that point of doing the investigation to now, we have had one youth offender who is now in the community come forward with a wage complaint to say that they were promised a wage from the work they did on the work crew, and they did not receive that. and that is being followed up by Office of Professional Standards, and it's also been turned over to OSP and the District Attorney's Office as a potential place of restitution. If there is a accountability for Mr. Humphreys. But we do not believe that the youth have been reimbursed for the work that they did.
Thank you.
I want to acknowledge the arrival of Representative Wisnick, Vice Chair of the Committee, and brag that the House side is at full strength now. I was also remiss in not acknowledging that we have a new member on the House Committee. Chris Harker has joined us as the newly appointed representative from the House district that Senator Bonamici vacated when she moved up to the Senate. So we welcome Representative Harker to our committee.
And his famous nameplate.
Right. It's bigger than the other ones.
Mr. Jester, it seems to me one of the key issues here is that it's difficult to have sufficient oversight from a distance when you have a facility as we have here that is in I think you mentioned 6-hour drive from Salem. And so the oversight of conduct there is going to necessarily be performed by people who work at the facility, and when the misconduct is allegedly being conducted by the person who is running the facility, then it puts the people who are subordinates at that same facility who are aware of it at, I think, in a very difficult situation, because they have to they are in the position of being needing to be whistleblowers if they see misconduct, and yet they put themselves at risk of retaliation. And obviously, that in the dismissals that have been grieved, that's kind of apparently a difficult issue there, because what is fair to expect a person to do who is reporting to the person whose misconduct is being brought to light. So I wanted to get your perspective on at what point should a subordinate be expected to blow the whistle on the person running the facility, because that's what allegedly occurred here.
Chair McPherson, absolutely. And we have spent a great deal of effort since the Michael Boyles case in working with staff and working with organized labor around the responsibility that we believe all of us have to ensure that the services we're providing are legal, that they're ethical, that we're properly using taxpayers' dollars, that staff are not violating the law, that we do not know of law violations. We have a code of conduct that is posted in all of our facilities. Now, in the case of Riverbend, we believe that we had a bully boss, somebody that was potentially threatening two staff. And additionally, there was information that was given to staff, at least on the cabinets, that there had been approval from central office for those cabinets to be built and installed in Mr. Humphrey's home. And so there was some questioning by the staff, I think, of whether or not there was approval given for these other activities as well. Mr. Lemon and I did go out to Riverbend immediately following our review. We met with every staff there and had this conversation. And we asked two things. Number one, that there are many avenues with which to make reporting, which we have talked to and trained staff to. It is not that they have to call Mr. Humphrey's supervisor or even myself as a director, that there is local law enforcement, there is Secretary of State's Office Abuse and Fraud Anonymous Hotline. There is a district attorney. There is a governor's ombudsperson. There are numbers of ways that staff can make a report that protects their anonymity, but also calls to the attention of others that can bring that accountability to that set of circumstances to bear. And it is the absence of people doing that, along with our managers, by the way, which did not report, that this kind of code of silence where people don't do that is one of the problems that we continue to work on with the culture.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Phil Lemon, Deputy Director. I think the other thing that's important in my mind anyway is that these were not violations of rule or policy necessarily that we're talking about. when the term kickback is used openly by staff in relationship to any employee, that I would hope clearly would signal a law violation, and the thought that the agency would ignore that or that nobody else in that community would be interested in pursuing that, whether it be a newspaper or law enforcement or the entities that Mr. Jester just suggested, is a mystery to me. And I think that everyone has to take some degree of personal responsibility and looking at them at their own ability and what their own position is in reporting that. Whether the agency did not do enough to encourage or solicit or respond to those reports, I think, is one thing. But the fact that someone could take what I would think clearly would be seen as a law violation and not act on that raises a number of other questions.
Let me do one more, and then I'll go back to some. Regarding this outreach that you did at River Bend with each of the employees, has that same tack been taken with other institutions in the sense of making certain before something may come about that they know what options they have to report such conduct?
Representative Przanski, I do a monthly bulletin to all of our staff, and we have, since the Riverbend situation was brought to light, we have talked about that, you know, if not every month, regularly, and have articulated places that they can go, numbers that they can use. We also do surveying of staff, and they have the opportunity in the performance-based standards to indicate any kind of suspicion of wrongdoing, and that did not show up in any surveys for Riverbend. Mr. Lemon's going to quickly go through the system improvement plan process, and there's an important element of that, and that is the recommendation that we do site visits both randomly as well as planned, and that we, every biennium, do a full business audit of every one of our operations, be it facility or field office. And we've actually started that process. We did it at North Coast and Warrenton, a 75-bed facility that we operate there. And we've done a full financial and business audit of that program as a model to pilot. And then we will begin going through all of our facilities, all of our field offices. There'll be one done every month, pulling our folks from central office out for 2 to 3 days, and in the course of the 24-month biennium, every piece of our operation will be reviewed.
I'll wait till after the rest of the testimony.
Phil. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your packet, I would just call your attention to two documents. The one titled Recommendations are the 26 recommendations that our internal review team came back from Riverbend in September of 2007 and said these are the things that we have reviewed and uncovered and think the agency needs to address. And as Mr. Jester previously indicated, we brought in Mr. Mink to lead that process, and I have included in your packet the System Improvement Project Report Introduction and Executive Summary. And so what that did was take those 26 recommendations. We created 12 work groups involving more than 60 employees throughout the agency, both management and represented from every segment of the agency, to discuss and make recommendations on how we would implement what the action plan is and steps we need to take to implement those 26 recommendations. So that is what is included in your packet. And rather than spend a lot of time going through those with you, let me just kind of cover some themes and highlights. We are in the process of identifying the top 10 or top tier of those recommendations that are most important to accomplish and would produce the greatest benefit, and we will do that within 90 days. And so our intent is by mid-September to bring back those people who constituted the Riverbend Review Team and say, you gave us 26 recommendations, here's our priorities, here's where we are, tell us how we're doing. So we will have that status check in the process. There are three, I would say, general areas of those priority recommendations. And I would just, before I get going on that, I would just say that the full report is about 50-some pages. And if the committee or staff would like to see that and review it in more detail, we'd be glad to provide that. We didn't want to throw too much paper at you here today, but we would certainly be glad to do that. There are three general areas that were raised both in the Riverbend Review and in the proceedings of the System Improvement Project, which really provided a forum for staff at all levels to identify issues that they thought the agency needed to address, regardless of whether they were specifically related to Riverbend. So one, as Mr. Jester's talked about, I would characterize as culture and climate issues. And so we are developing a formal expectation that at least twice a year, every work site in the agency will be visited by one of four people. That would be the director, myself, the assistant director for facility operations, or the assistant director for field operations. The intent is to provide both formal and informal opportunities to interact. So we would talk to them about what that work site's performance is, what the issues are there, what we see as things that they need to work on. They would have a chance to communicate directly to senior leadership in the agency on their views of those things.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. Lemon, thank you for being here today. How many facilities are we talking about?
We have 11 correctional facilities or camps. We have 11 field offices. And then in addition to those 11 field offices, we have places where our parole officers are housed. But we have basically 11 supervised work sites in the field and 11 on the facility side.
So physical visits twice a year to 22?
Yes, sir.
Physical places? And there's how many people that you just said would make those visits?
Four.
Are we not doing that today? Isn't that kind of a normal thing for management to get around to see facilities? What are you doing today?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Cameron, we are getting around today. The difference is, as Mr. Jester gave an example, when you go to Riverbend in LeGrand, when you go to Eastern Oregon in Burns, it's difficult to do a drop-by. And so those are more formal, scheduled interactions where we go up there for a specific purpose, for a specific reason. The recommendation here is that we enhance that we have, if you will, FaceTime with staff in a staff meeting where we talk directly, not just to the managers of the institute or the facility, but to the staff members in a staff meeting and have that open interaction. The second component of that is unannounced visits. And we don't have a request for unannounced visits, but that was specifically one of the things that and this came out of the committee that I facilitated, said was of value and we needed to do more of that. Just so there wasn't, to the extent that, you know, we're polishing the silverware because the relatives are coming over, when you do an advance visit without notice, you avoid that ability. And so we're in the process of starting to schedule those visits and also just to make sure that we're doing more of that. It's much easier. I mean, Bob and I are up in McLaren in Woodburn all the time. And we have meetings there. We meet with folks. We go to trainings. We speak at trainings. But we don't go out always to the living units just to talk to staff, talk to youth, see what's going on. And so we will be making a more concerted effort to do more of that. Now, Mr. Florup, who is the assistant director for facilities, is there on a regular basis much more than we are, does more of that. And so it's, again, just emphasizing that there's a value in both formal and informal interactions, scheduled and unscheduled visits, and we'll set up a process to do that. But I don't want to leave you with the impression that we never go to our facilities or field offices on a regular basis.
Thank you. Mr. Wisner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lemon, when we had our one-on-one meeting and we talked about this, one of the things I suggested, and I don't see it in your recommendations here under supervision and oversight, is the fact that opening up a block of time that the staff can come in and talk to you directly without any repercussions or anything like that. Based upon my experience, that happens within the military structure, that the people at the lowest level have an opportunity to talk to higher-ups, and that may have helped in this situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's in the detail of the recommendation, and again, the formal and informal structure, and again, the discussion and intent was to, rather than just, for example, reading a message from the director in the monthly bulletin, that they actually recognize him, they talk to him, they have some idea of who he is and what his values are as a person, and have that additional level of comfort and interaction on a general basis, and then also creating specific opportunities to have that happen.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. That's what we talked about is somewhat, but the staff, the workers have to have the opportunity to come in and talk and not have any repercussions and then one of the four will have to then work with the director or decide how you're going to work with the director to solve this. So thank you.
And the other thing, frankly, that came up, there's the perception in some staff that, you know, senior management, A, is unapproachable, B, not interested, and C, just not out there doing the kind of management or walking around that you're talking about. And to the extent that is a perception based on reality, we want to take steps to address that.
Last comment, Mr. But that's up to you then. You've got to be sure that people get the understanding that they have that opportunity and there'll be no repercussions.
Got a couple more questions here, but Mr. Jester, Mr. Lemon, I wanted to ask, since we're a little past our time here on this topic, if you covered all the ground that you would like to get before the committee, aside from the questions that committee members have.
If I can just make a couple brief summary remarks on the system improvement. The other priority areas that are being looked at, in addition to the culture and climate, there's a number of things in there that I won't take your time to go through. The second issue that came up in the Riverbend Review is just a look at our business processes and what our internal controls are for property management, for purchasing authority. Mr. Jester talked about the comprehensive site review. We need to do a better job tracking state vehicle use. We're looking at cell phone use and even just the fundamentals of how we can document and establish time worked, leave taken, who needs to know in that process, and making sure that we're having that increased accountability that has come up in this. The final area relates to management. And there are a number of issues there in terms of managers attending the same training that staff do to make sure that everyone is on the same page and has that opportunity to train as a team and to get that common understanding, to improve staff feedback in the performance appraisals of managers so we have that additional feedback loop, how well managers do in communicating expectations of the agency and of that position. And we talked about a culture and climate survey, which we will try to incorporate many of those elements so we have an ongoing way over time to measure changes both throughout the agency and at the individual work sites. And so I think those are kind of the three main areas where the consensus among both the management of the agency and the labor organizations and representative staff are the areas that we need to focus on in that 90-day window, and we'll be having a better report in September once we've gone through that process.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Jester, you would agree that the buck stops with you, but when you have people working for you, people do stupid things, particularly if there's collusion among staff. Even if you have good systems, if there's collusion, it's pretty difficult to spot that. And while the buck stops at you, you have people working for you that presumably are supposed to be kind of keeping a closer eye on this than you could in an 8 or 15 hour day that you probably put in. So who is the Mr. Humphreys reported to the assistant director of facilities, is that correct?
That's correct.
And who is that person?
Brian Thorpe.
And is there, has there been any type of evaluation of his performance in this?
Co-chairs and Representative Shields, there has been. And one of the questions that we have asked both the staff in Riverbend and our business services folks is there any information that we have not yet, that has not yet come forward, that is two dots and a line between Mr. Florup and Mr. Humphreys regarding any kinds of these activities? And the one, quite frankly, that is, you know, very concerning is that there is a perception that staff were given by Mr. Humphreys that these cabinets were approved by Mr. Florup to both be made and installed in Mr. Humphrey's home. And so we take, as I stated previously in my testimony, we take any allegations of misconduct seriously. And it is the practice of the Oregon Authority to investigate and follow up on any allegation of misconduct, and that would also be true with Mr. Florup.
And just a quick follow-up. So the person who oversaw probation and parole during the Boyles crisis and catastrophe, who was that person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, Robin Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on Senator Whitsitt's question about the work project issue, and I guess it was in response to your statement that the youth did not know that there were any improprieties in what they were doing. Is it typical for a work project to be done in a private residence, and is there any indication that the youth on that project knew that it was Mr. Humphrey's home they were working on?
Co-chairs and Senator Bonamici, that's an excellent question, and we believe from interviews that, in fact, youth did not know it was Mr. Humphrey's private residence. The kinds of work crews that youth are involved in doing, for example, in our Florence work-study program, there is a concentration of youth that go out and do construction work and learn construction trades that is both followed up in classroom and then in practical applications where home builders come to the camp and use youth labor and pay them. So it is a model that is not unique to Riverbend. They have done a number of community service projects where they may go to a home and, you know, clean up a yard and put down bark dust and clean it up, and it might be a person otherwise could not do that, and it would be, the restitution would be in the form of community service hours. That is one of the areas that law enforcement district attorney's office is looking into, and we have not done a parallel investigation until theirs is completed.
Thank you. And a brief follow-up? Thank you. Can you please explain what the changes will be? One of your recommendations is formalizing the authorization process for youth work projects. What are you looking at in terms of changing that process?
If I may, Senator Phil Lemon, again, it would be a formal process that would be uniform throughout the agency, that before any project is considered to send youth crews out on it, there will be a formal project proposal with a number of details about who's requesting it, what the elements of the proposal are, and have those reviewed by a group rather than just having it done informally by an individual or small group of individuals.
Thank you.
The other thing. To access that service or product than an ordinary Oregonian would.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, for the record, Mr. Jester, to the best of your knowledge, Mr. Humphreys, who was employed by the taxpayers at a good salary and stole or just misused money, will retire with his full PERS benefits, which is a significant PERS. Could you say yes or no?
Co-chairs and Representative Wisnett, yes.
Very briefly. My question is, does the Oregon Youth Authority come under the Oregon Administrative Rules for Corrections or Schools? Because these performance standards here, are they already contained in administrative rules? I guess that, and how, what rules do you follow?
Mr. Chair, as a comp, I'm not sure what your question is.
My question, to clarify that, as a school administrator, I followed our school district policies, but we also have a tremendous amount of Oregon Administrative Rules, OARs, that guide our professional code of conduct. And I was just wondering what code of conduct of procedures and practices does the Oregon Youth Authority fall under?
Let me try to answer it this way and let me know if I've addressed your question. The Oregon Youth Authority follows the same state statutes as every other state agency, to the extent that DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, has rules or policies that govern all state agencies. We subscribe to them. The principles of conduct that Mr. Jester referred to are adopted by the agency as a policy, and we train and enforce that specific to our agency. In terms of business controls, many of the Oregon Accounting Manual, for example, those standards talk about a reasonable review before signature, before authorization, before approval. And so what many of the things that we're talking about in our system improvement project is to define for the Oregon Youth Authority what constitutes a reasonable review, to make sure we've communicated that to our managers and train them to that, and then enforce those standards.
Just for clarification, so you don't have a policy handbook that has all that stated at this time?
Yes, we do. We have a policy handbook, and we're trying to boil that down into a kind of field or a desk notebook that helps managers follow the myriad of requirements and expectations that we would have of them.
Thank you.
Co-chairs representing comp, just to add to that, they're all electronically accessible through all of our sites, and there's actually a search. You can put in a search word, and it will take you to either to a DAS, to an OAR, to an ORS, to a Oregon Youth Authority policy or procedure. It's a fairly sophisticated electronic system that brings policies, procedures, and laws and administrative rules up on a screen for people to read and follow.
Thank you.
Mr. Lemon and Mr. Jester, thank you very much for coming in. We've gone past our time allotted to this subject, but it is an important subject. Thank you for your work on this. You know, obviously, any time there's a violation of the public trust, as apparently occurred out at the Brookbend facility, it's a very serious matter. We need to make sure that the public is reassured, and appreciate your efforts to try and get your procedures in line and to build the kind of culture we need within OIA to make sure that this doesn't happen again, and I urge you to go forward and deliver the message that this is not the way business is conducted by the state of Oregon, and that people should feel as though they would be protected if they identify the errors that they observe when they're out in these remote facilities.
Mr. Chair, I really apologize. I didn't realize we were coming so closely on the time.
We're actually 18 minutes over time.
I think there is an issue that has been brought up about Oak Creek that I think the safety of the kids there that I would love to have.
You can bring that up with the agency directly. We have another time. I've already told this agency, and I've told the representatives of the employees today. We're dealing with River Bend. We're not going to ambush them or anyone else at this point. We're not going to open this up full day on Oregon Youth Authority. We have two other meetings that we need to take care of, and so I'm going to rule on my side. The question's out of line for today, and you should take it up with them. I just received the testimony that was being presented for us to review, and I think it's only fair for all of us to be on the same page before we go down that line.
I can appreciate that. It certainly wasn't meant to be an ambush. In fact, I discussed it with the director before him. But if it's if
now we're 20 minutes, minutes,
I can appreciate
we're
that.
We're 20 minutes right. Over. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
We'll now move on to the next topic in our informational meeting, which is on questions related to the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And we're going to go in a different order than what we have listed here on the agenda. I think it would be helpful to get the issue framed by inviting Joel Leary, the Governor's Office Public Safety Policy Advisor, forward to introduce this issue.
Thank you, Chairs McPherson and Krasowski. It is, again, as always, a pleasure to appear in front of you. If I at any time look a little bit discomforted or discombobulated, I want to apologize in advance. I had a little bit of a back episode 2 days ago. Am on a little bit of legally prescribed medication, which I cut back this morning. which I cut back on this morning in order to be alert and hopefully somewhat cogent. So you can review my performance privately afterwards if you'd like.
Tiger Woods just won the U.S. Open playing
with a very positive knee. I know.
Serious injuries.
I'm sure you could. If I could only live up to that standard. Thank you. I'm pleased to speak with you about the Governor's Psychiatric Security Review Board citing work group that was convened several months ago and has been meeting since late April. I previously provided to committee staff copies of the membership list of the citing work group, a copy of the citing work group's goals and charge, a copy of the work group's work plan, copies of the agenda from the two meetings that the work group has had thus far, and copies of the minutes from the first meeting. And then today I'm providing you a hard copy of a one-page sort of frequently asked questions, fast facts document that addresses several issues that overlap with what the work group is doing. I want to take just a second and give you the big picture context of what we're talking about. You'll recall that individuals who are accused of criminal conduct and who are believed to have severe mental health issues are treated slightly differently at the front end of the criminal justice system. In many cases, those individuals assert what is known as the guilty except for insanity defense, which was created several decades ago under Oregon law. Under a GEI, the person must prove to the finder of fact that because of a mental disease or defect, I believe the language is a severe mental disease or defect, the person either cannot appreciate the nature of their conduct or cannot conform their conduct to the requirements of law. You also may recall that a person who is found guilty except for insanity and adjudicated that way by the finder of fact, either the judge or the jury, or in some cases by stipulation of the parties, is placed within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The length of that jurisdiction is the maximum possible sentence that is the indeterminate sentence provided by statute. So not the sentencing guidelines, but rather you fall back to the 5, 10, 20, or life sentence that was provided for an ABC felony or murder. Initially, in almost every case, the individual placed in the jurisdiction of the PSRB is committed by the trial judge to the Oregon State Hospital. And that is where that person remains unless and until the Psychiatric Security Review Board determines that they are not a substantial danger to self or others, that they can be adequately controlled with supervision and treatment in the community, and the supervision and treatment in the community is available. The primary responsibility of the Psychiatric Security Review Board in determining whether a person should be committed or conditionally released from the state hospital is public safety according to state law. Some of these burdens and statutes are referred to in the Fast Facts document here that I have handed you out. So this is the context. The PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, folks who are committed to the state hospital, and at some point, most of whom are later at some point found to be safe to be released to the state hospital. Some of those folks are released according to clinical judgment and more objective evaluation to different types of settings. And this is where the citing work group's work really comes in, because we are looking at the process by which the what they call secure residential treatment facilities, places that house individuals in PSRB jurisdiction who are being released from the state hospital into the community, are placed. Not all, but many. Actually, the second page, I believe, of this document that I handed out to you today, in the gray bar along the right-hand side, gives you an idea. About 10.5% of the PSRB clients are released to this type of setting. Now, I also want to give you, that's kind of the legal, practical context. I want to give you the context in which this came on the radar of the governor's office. And it started in late 2007 when actually Aaron Kelly Seal, who is my peer on the governor's staff, the governor's advisor for human services issues, received some contacts from stakeholders she had in the mental health community about concerns that law enforcement specifically had regarding the placement of individuals in, actually I shouldn't say concerning placement of individuals, but concerning these secure residential treatment facilities and the placement of where the secure residential treatment facilities were going in. when Aaron let me know about those concerns, and in response to that, I reached out to individually to them, Dave Burright, the executive director of the Oregon Sheriff's Association, who turned me over to Rob Gordon, the Washington County Sheriff. And I had several other informal contacts with the Association of Chiefs of Police, the District Attorney's Association. And what I learned from those contacts was that there indeed was concern and confusion on behalf of the law enforcement community regarding the process by which secure residential treatment facilities are sited in the community. There was also concern and confusion over their ability to access information about that process and about what individuals within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board were being placed in which facilities in the community. This was at about the same time that you may recall, I'm scanning to see if anyone was a member of the House Women's Wellness and Health Policy Committee in December it was in December of 2007, about the same time that we were hearing concerns. There was a hearing in the House Committee on this very issue with testimony from members of law enforcement, representatives of DHS, representatives of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And it was clear from that hearing that there were at least two major issues that were of concern from law enforcement. And one was this issue of notice. How the law enforcement representatives in the communities in which the secure residential treatment facilities are located are getting notified, or whether they are getting notified, when an individual in the PSRB's jurisdiction is released from the state hospital to that facility. And the law enforcement contention in that hearing was that they were not being notified. And there were questions that really had not been fleshed out about the access to that information and what could legally be released and what could not legally be released, and various state and federal law overlays. There were also questions regarding what, if any, was the appropriate amount of community involvement that was happening or should happen in the determination to site a secure residential treatment facility in a given community. After listening to the testimony of that hearing and speaking with Aaron, I actually looked back and talked to Bob Junedep of the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Aaron and I had several conversations with our contacts at the PSRB and our contacts at the Department of Human Services, and it became clear that there were two issues. One was a relatively straightforward issue to my mind, and one was a more complicated one. The first issue, notice to law enforcement in the receiving county, the county in which the PSRB is agreeing to conditional release someone in their jurisdiction. Two, the more thorny issue that was the issue that is the subject of the work group is the citing process and what the parameters around that citing process are. I want to let you know how we resolved the first issue, the notice to law enforcement, because it really, in my opinion, it was low-hanging fruit. And that policy changed very quickly right after that hearing, actually, once we did the investigation and figured out that there was public information, and certainly information that is provided in the law enforcement data system that law enforcement has access to, that could be released to law enforcement in the receiving county. It's important to note on this, there is a statute already that says that when the PSRB conditionally releases a person to the community from the state hospital, that the district attorney and the judge who presided over the case get notice. Actually, they get notice of all of the hearings prior to that lead up to the conditional release hearing itself, so that they can have an opportunity to appear and object and call witnesses, etc. But what we realized was there were circumstances where individuals were being released into a county where a secure residential treatment facility was located that was not the same county out of which they were adjudicated guilty except for insanity. So you could have many situations where an individual was convicted, as it were, in Clackamas County, for example, but released to Klamath County to a secure residential treatment facility. I'm making those counties up, by the way. I don't know that there was a case like that, or a site in Klamath County. But so in that kind of circumstance, the Clackamas County District Attorney and the presiding the judge that presided over the case in Clackamas County would have all kinds of information about the case and the hearings and the conditional release conditions and where the person was going, etc. But the sheriff, prosecutor, police chief, etc. in Klamath County would not. We did learn, however, that in more cases than not, the local mental health director, county mental health director, does have that information in the receiving county. But as we all know, it's not always the case, be it in state government or in county government or in any government, that the right hand always knows what the left hand is doing. And out of the acknowledgement of that fact, the governor's office asked the PSRB to develop a formal notice that would be provided upon every conditional release of a PSRB jurisdiction person from the state hospital to the community that would go to, our initial direction to them was that it would go to the sheriff in the county, in the receiving county. And the PSRB worked out the form of that notice with the Oregon Advocacy Center, which includes the name, address, the name of the offender, the individual within the board's jurisdiction, the address that they'll be residing, the underlying offense that they were found guilty except for insanity of, the type of placement that they're being placed in, and the case manager, the local case manager, name and contact information. The first of those notices went out on January 3rd, 2008, to Washington County, actually. We subsequently amended that process, and it was after a consultation meeting with members of law enforcement in late January of 2008. Aaron and I met with representatives of the District Attorney's Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Sheriff's Association, and the League of Oregon Cities. Among the folks in the room were John Foote, Kevin Neely was there.
Yes.
Kevin Campbell, Chief Wells from Independence, Sheriff Rob Gordon, Sheriff Ramirez, and Sheriff Wolf. And the feedback when we presented them with the new notice policy and the form, the feedback that we got, they were pleased that we were doing it. But they also, particularly the League of Oregon Cities and the police chiefs, urged us to also provide that same notice not only to the county sheriff but to the police chief, and we talked about how we wouldn't, the PSRB wouldn't necessarily know, legal boundary, blah blah blah, but we'd have an address, and what the PSRB agreed to was whatever city was listed on the address of the residential treatment facility, or not just this for anybody actually, that being released from the state hospital under their jurisdiction, the notice would go to the police chief of whatever city was listed in that address. So there are really duplicative notices going out now to the sheriff of the county and to the police chief of the person's legal address. Yes. Now, in the same meeting where we were discussing the notice, the second issue, the more thorny issue of citing and the citing process came up. And it was clear to me in that stakeholder meeting with law enforcement that there was a desire to more formally address the citing issue. And it was also clear to me that it was not something that could just be done internally within DHS, within the PSRB, or just with contact through law enforcement. So So what Aaron and I did was, in the course of that meeting and then in subsequent contacts with that law enforcement stakeholder group, we asked them what issues around the citing process they would like to address if we were to form a more holistic work group, and we received their input, and then what we did was we set out in talking to the other stakeholder groups that we knew would have to be involved. We met in early February with a group of stakeholders from the mental health community that included Bob Junedepth, several mental health consumers, representatives of NAMI, county mental health directors, the Association of Oregon Counties, I believe Paul Snyder was part of that meeting, and several treatment providers, as well as folks internal to the Department of Human Services who oversee the citing process. We informed them of the change in the policy of notice to law enforcement, which had actually gotten out to the mental health community, and that there was already some concern and misinformation about that was helpful to clear up. And we also discussed the intent to convene a work group on this bigger picture of the siting of these facilities. We obtained their input in the issue development, and it was really out of the meetings with law enforcement and the meeting with the mental health stakeholders that we later formed the work plan, which I'm going to describe, that is guiding our work. We did have one other stakeholder meeting, as it were, in late February, just before the close of the supplemental session, with several legislative members, including Senator Przanski, I believe Senator Morse, Representative Tomei, Representative Maurer, and Representative Olson. So this really brought us to the point where, at the close of the February session, we knew that there was this issue out there. We knew it was complicated. We knew it was emotional. We knew it was thorny. We knew it was legally complicated. There were federal overlays. There were people, by this time, reports in the media, and by this time reports of individuals getting sued over statements and actions with respect to these facilities. So we also knew that there were different angles and funds of knowledge from the various stakeholder communities. The law enforcement folks didn't know and understand all of the complexities that the mental health folks knew and understood. And conversely, the mental health folks didn't know and understand all of the complexities that the law enforcement folks knew and experienced on this issue. So what we set out to do was to balance those complications with an inclusive process that was going to be thoughtful, thorough, and very methodical. And our first step was to find a facilitator. We didn't think that this was something that we could just get a group of people into a room and have a free-for-all on. So we actually sought the input of many of the stakeholders that we spoke to in coming to that point, and we landed on Judge Darrell Larson, who is a Plan B semi-retired circuit court judge from Lane County. He is the newly appointed, as of last session, chair of the Criminal Justice Commission, a longtime prosecutor himself in his prior career before he came circuit court judge, and as circuit court judge oversaw Lane County's drug court and has a lot of experience with the intersection of mental health and criminal justice system issues. With Judge Larson's help, we set out to invite members, and wherever we could, we looked to the associations that we reached out to and their leadership, the District Attorney's Association, the sheriffs, the chiefs of police, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm probably leaving a few out, but we look to those associations to appoint members to the work group, and we ask the presiding officers of each chamber to appoint two representatives from the Senate and two from the House, one R, one D. Hopefully you have the membership list
No.
Sorry.
I don't think we do.
I will be sure to get that to you. I didn't bring extra copies. I intended to electronically send that. I should have made it more clear. Our legislative members are Senator Jackie Winters and Senator Przanski, which we greatly appreciate the tie to judiciary. Our House members are Representative Andy Olson, Representative Carolyn Tomei. Representative Tomei, by the way, was the chair of the Health Policy and Women's Wellness Committee that heard this issue back in December. Our District Attorney Association member is Walt Beglau from Marin County, who's present. Our Sheriff's Association representative is Rob Gordon from Washington County. From the Chiefs, we have Tualat and Chief Kent Barker, who's the president of the Association of Chiefs of Police. Mayor Dan Bedore of Albany was LOC's representative. Representatives from the Senate and two from the House, 1R, 1D. Hopefully you have the membership list. No, sorry.
I don't think we do.
I will be sure to get that to you. I didn't bring extra copies. I intended to electronically send that. I should have made it more clear. Our legislative members are Senator Jackie Winters and Senator Przanski, which we greatly appreciate the tie to judiciary. Our House members are Representative Andy Olson, Representative Carolyn Tomei. Representative Tomei, by the way, was the chair of the Health Policy and Women's Wellness Committee that heard this issue back in December. Our District Attorney Association member is Walt Beglau from Marin County, who's present. Our Sheriff's Association representative is Rob Gordon from Washington County. From the Chiefs, we have Tualat and Chief Kent Barker, who's the president of the Association of Chiefs of Police. Mayor Dan Bedore of Albany was LOC's representative. AOC's representative is Commissioner Jay Dixon, who's also the chair of AOC's Criminal Justice Subcommittee. We have the Washington County Mental Health Director representing the Association of Community Mental Health Providers, Ellen Pitcher from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have only one representative of the PSRB on the work group. That's Barry Cast, who is a public member of the PSRB. And then we have four treatment provider members. Bob Jindeff for the Oregon Advocacy Center, Carol Schrader, who is the director of the Crime Victims Rights Compliance Project, representing the crime victim advocacy community. We requested representation from Attorney General Hardy Myers for that. And then we have four consumers, mental health consumers, on the board, one of whom is actually an employee at the Oregon State Hospital, and I think three of whom have been within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. You'll recall Senate Bill 364 from 2005, which actually requires 20% of any committee or work group having to do with mental health issues to require consumer representation. So there is always a balance in a work group between size and productivity. We try our best to err on inclusivity. We also decided that in each of our meetings we would provide an opportunity for public testimony, knowing that this was an issue that people felt strongly about and that we did not have as many seats at the table, if you will, official seats at the table, for everyone who was interested. And we've had a lot of folks who have come and taken advantage of the public testimony, many folks who have come to observe. We've been happy that Representative Flores has attended both of our meetings thus far. Our goals of this work group are actually written out in a document that I will get to you. The overarching goal is to increase mutual understanding of the system itself, the system by which PSRB individuals are placed within the board and released, conditionally released from the hospital under what circumstances that happens. And our second goal, high-level goal, is to reach consensus on the ways of strengthening the process for the siting of residential treatment facilities.
that serve PSRB clients. The same document more specifically outlines the charge that the governor gave the group, and that is to make recommendations specifically to the governor and to the 2009 Legislative Assembly with respect to opportunities to strengthen the process used to site these facilities serving PSRB clients. We are to clarify the roles and the functions of state government entities, local entities, contractors, in the siting process, and we are to seek ways to make this process consistent and transparent. Secondly, we are to develop principles and guidelines for involving affected communities, neighborhoods, counties, cities, and other public entities, and any other individual parties in the siting process. The guiding values in our work are protecting public safety, consistent with the statute governing the PSRB, protecting the safety and individual rights of individuals with mental illness, and supporting the effective treatment of individuals with mental illness, all while recognizing the budget realities of state and local partners. The work plan itself is really front-loaded with tutorial meetings. We've had two so far, the first on April 22nd and the last on May 19th. And what we have sought to do was to try to take everybody, as I mentioned, with different funds of knowledge from different sectors and backgrounds to a similar level of understanding of the process. We started out with an overview of Oregon's mental health system. We talked about the basics of criminal responsibility and the GEI disposition. And we talked a lot about this, how a person comes within the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, for how long they stay, and under what circumstances they can be conditionally released. In our second meeting, we actually continued the primer on the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and we talked about the conditional release process and the clinical and objective instruments that are used to make recommendations to the board about conditional release. We talked about the four layers of review, hospital, PSRB, community, potential receiving community, and back to PSRB, that are followed before an individual is granted conditional release. And we also then moved into the current siting process and what the parameters, to the extent there are any, and the practices are for the siting of these facilities currently. And then we had a presentation that was requested by some of the members that was a bigger picture presentation that compared data within the Psychiatric Security Review Board versus within the criminal justice system, data like population, types of crimes, recidivism rates, etc. Some of that is reflected in the document that I've provided you today. Our next meeting, it's actually not a meeting, our next gathering will be on June 23rd, on Monday. We're actually doing a field trip. We're going to a secure residential treatment facility in Woodburn, and then we're going to go to a residential treatment facility in Milwaukee. The management of those two facilities have made arrangements for us to be broken up into two groups so we don't overwhelm them, and are actually going to meet with the management, see at least two of these facilities and what they look like, and meet with the staff and possibly talk to some of the clients who are living there. Our July meeting is probably going to be our last informational meeting before we get into our real work sessions. We're going to have a panel presentation from someone who is within the PSRB's jurisdiction, from the victim of a crime committed by an individual found guilty except for insanity and committed to the PSRB, and panelist who is a neighbor of one of the secure residential treatment facilities. And then we're also going to have the meat of this meeting really is going to be an informational presentation on all of these tricky legal issues that surround the siting process, federal fair housing, ADA, HIPAA, to name a few, and Mickey Logan from the Department of Justice, the Oregon Department of Justice, is going to provide that training, and we're going to apply for CLE credits, and knock on wood, I hope we get it. I took a little bit of medication this morning, only a little. We're also going to have a presentation on, that was from the knock on wood to my head. Sorry if you didn't all see it on the other side of the panel. We're also going to have a presentation on the Oregon State Hospital master plan and get a little more flesh around what the state's plan is for long-term institutional and community mental health. Our last two meetings that are scheduled for September and October are really reserved for the work, and we hope to have productive work sessions that are relying on all of our individual experiences, as well as all of that information that we are trying to thoroughly and methodically go through. We hope to come up, as I said, our keystone here is ways to strengthen the process by which the state manages folks who have been found guilty except for insanity once they have been determined safe to be released into the community. And I can tell you this is by no means an easy process, but I think there is an opportunity to find common ground, and Aaron and Judge Larson and I will continue to make efforts to do that.
Yeah. We use it most of the time here that we had a lot of this subject here, and I want to make sure we have an opportunity to get others to present and the schedule. We had some questions for Mr. O'Leary.
Mine's quick, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The board, Mr. O'Leary, any representation from across the mountain?
On the siting work group, Representative Wisnant, there is a representative from Umatilla whose name is going to escape me, but he is one of the treatment provider representatives, and I will get that to you for sure.
We have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. We have a, you know, this is a big issue in Central Oregon, which is going to population, and we'd like to have representation from Central Oregon. We are looking at residential treatment facilities. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Joe, you have been around this quite a while, and we've had a lot of conversations about mental health court needs. This is real life regarding siting. But when these people are being transitioned into these type of facilities, what type of services do they continue to have? How do you enforce the meds and the assessment process of that?
Chairs Krasonski and McPherson, Representative Krieger, what I have learned, and I myself have learned a lot, even though I was involved as a practitioner in this process, is that when a person is diverted into the Psychiatric Security Review Board system, as opposed to the criminal justice system, from the presentations I have heard, it is apparent that there are greater services provided and faster consequences if those services are not complied with. And I'm not the expert. Mary Claire Buckley can probably speak to that better than I. But it is truly a different system. And I look at it that way because I compare, as you know, offender reentry is a very important issue to me, and is the subject of your last informational meeting, and I see that really as an even bigger issue, and in scope it is, because the sheer number of individuals who are going through the criminal justice system as opposed to the PSRB system are huge. There are 745 people within the PSRB jurisdiction. There are 13,600 and some people in the Department of Corrections, 4,000 of which are released every year, and about 20% of which have severe mental illness. For whatever reason, Those individuals on the criminal side did not assert the GEI. They've been found criminally responsible, but they also have mental illness that they struggle with. And to my mind, that's a risk factor that we need to take into account. And those are the folks who are going into community corrections when they are released, some of whom have specific caseloads for mental health. Some of them don't.
One little follow-up. Do they have any type of program for them, or do they become functional to be employed anywhere?
Representative Krieger, the folks who come out of the PSRB process, I'm not familiar with the statistics intimately enough to be able to tell you. I can just tell you kind of anecdotally that the four individuals, or three of whom who are four consumers on the panel, three of whom who I believe were in PSRB jurisdiction, are all now successful, law-abiding. They went to they got treatment. They went to school. At least one of them I know has a professional employment. And
maybe you could get something for us about what services they receive to prepare them and, so they have some success.
I can get you more specifics on that.
Representative Barker. Thank you very briefly. The Portland Police Association, Robert King's the president, and Mitch Copps, the secretary and treasurer, they're telling me that cops have no idea where any of these places are. I mean, it may be getting lost in the dark hole of chief's office, which I'll take up with Kevin Campbell, but I do think it would be important that the emergency communication center have those addresses flagged for everybody's safety. And the other thing, you have consumers of the system on the board, but nobody from Crime Victims United or a crime victim, and I would like to suggest in the most strong manner that you should have a representative of the victims on those, on that board, if at all possible, to get that changed.
Chair Przanski, Representative McPherson, I appreciate that suggestion, and it was actually in response to that suggestion that Aaron and I approached the Attorney General and asked him for a representative of the victim community, and the Attorney General recommended Carol Schrader.
But I'd like to see a victim rather than just another government official that works with them. Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, thank you, Mr. O'Leary. We've got a couple of representatives scheduled from the Legislative Council, but before that, Representative Flores said, because of your special interest in this issue, you wanted to deliver some remarks, and you could do it either where you are or from the table as you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, and I promise that I did not take any approved drug dose this morning, so I'll speak very rapidly in respect for our time limits here. And I appreciate you giving me a brief opportunity just to share my observations and perspectives on this concerning and growing debate about the placement of community facilities for forensic patients. And please know that there is a distinction between forensic patients and those who are under civil commitment and with mental health issues. About 9 months ago, some law enforcement officers, folks came to me, and we had conversations about placement of a secure residential treatment facility. And it was about the same time that there was a similar facility being sited in Clackamas County. And I, too, along with Mr. O'Leary, learned an awful lot about this very, very complex subject. And there are many, many issues that are kind of interwoven, and therefore it becomes a very knotty KNOTTY issue. And we won't begin to cover them here today, but you'll hear some of them laid out. And Mr. O'Leary did a very good job about the concerns of community interest, and you'll hear an executive perspective, and I hope to just give you a little bit of a legislator's perspective on this as well. Also, let me start by saying that some of the numbers that I give you might be a little bit off, because sometimes it's hard to get some accuracy and balance and make them square with some of the information we've been given over in the past. But when I did talk to the police chief, sheriff, and a district attorney involved in a facility, I was very troubled as well. And you heard about secure residential treatment facility, the most secure possible of housing for clients who have been released from the Oregon State Hospital by the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB. And we're talking about, just to be clear, sex offenders, arsonists, murderers, serious assault, and other violent crimes. I did provide testimony to that December House and Human Health and Human Services for Women's Wellness Committee, along with police and prosecutors. And I was also invited to a meeting in Hillsborough, actually, where over 300 very, very concerned citizens, residents of the neighborhood, who found out that a secure residential treatment facility was being placed in their community, and one of the residents that was being moved into that facility was a child sex offender. This facility was next to a daycare, next to a school bus stop, next to families. That was the source of their serious concern. I've been working with legislative counsel to understand the laws governing this particular area, and I have looked at other state laws. I've met with mental health staff, and I've been sitting in on the work group, as Mr. O'Leary mentioned, that the governor has formed to deal with this issue. Oregon Police Chiefs, Oregon Sheriff's Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and Crime Victims United have all come forward and are pleading for changes in the law. And it's great to hear that we have everything is aligning as far as what the goals of the work group, governor's work group, are and some of the early modifications that remain. So we share two major concerns. First, the lack of transparency, openness, and notification. And second, the lack of uniform standards and process. Excuse me. It's clear there's a fundamental policy shift that has been going on here, and that has been acknowledged. The replacement project for the state hospital and other factors are shifting the emphasis towards getting the guilty except for insanity offenders into the community as soon as possible. The district attorneys did a study on the average length of stay in the state hospital, and it's much shorter than it was 10 years ago. The state also started building secure facilities over the past 10 years, and that's really where the primary concern rests. These clients present the most risk, the highest danger to the community. Please understand, once again, and to be very clear, this is not about fear of people with mental illness. It is a community safety concern because of the high-risk offenders in these facilities. And I believe there are about 8 facilities around the state and more scheduled. The agency people will tell you they have a great track record, and I think it's listed on the fast fact sheet that was handed out, that the recidivism rate is 2.2%, but we need to look a little bit deeper. The recidivism measurement keeps changing. Once we were told, I have in writing, that the recidivism measurement is based on felony convictions over a 3-year period. Another document indicates, no, it's arrest, not convictions. However, we have to keep in mind that recidivism rates for the corrections population, making that comparison is not really a straight-up comparison. And we're not adding all the patients who had their conditional release revoked and got sent back to the state hospital. And they don't count misdemeanor crimes, some of which, as you are aware, can be very, very serious. So where do we go from here? Once again, I'm very encouraged about the better notification piece for law enforcement, for the district attorney, for even the fire marshal, so that they know what's coming to their community. And yes, I do believe that citizens in a community need to know who's moving next door to them. Mr. O'Leary mentioned the Federal Fair Housing Act and why And that argument comes into place in regard to being discriminatory against people with mental health issues. And I would ask you to think about homeowners, neighbors, who feel pretty discriminated against when no one wants to buy their house when they have one of these types of facilities placed in their neighborhood because of the residents that are being placed there. The secondary concern is in regard to standards, and we're learning from the governor's workforce there are really no uniform standards for the facilities. There isn't a list of building codes or security requirements for staff training. There really aren't any consistent protocols for the process used when one of the secure residential treatment facilities is placed in a community. In fact, in some cases, the neighbors have been notified as part of the siting process, but in most cases not until after the fact, and that has been by word of mouth. So as we talk about implications of changing Oregon law, I have three legislative council opinions, including the that talks about these issues, including the Federal Fair Housing Act. And each of those leaves room for the potential to craft a law that would allow for notification in the interest of public safety. And here again, the focus would be only on those in secure facilities which carry the highest risk and have the highest need for high security. I will just wrap up, Mr. Chair, that I am a very big advocate for people in mental health programs. I've been involved with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Clackamas County for several years. I've worked on legislation to protect funding for the Damish property in Villebois, which you would know as Villebois now, and for housing people with, which houses people with chronic mental illness, and I've pushed very hard for the mental health parity bill. I believe the vast majority of the community placements, especially for civil commitments, are working well and they help clients on the road to recovery. My concern, again, is about the community safety issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity, to share my concerns and comments.
Any questions for Representative Forrest?
Thank
you, Representative. And then finally, we have two people from the Legislative Council's office, Joshua Nasby and Lori Freeman. And while they're coming forward,
explain. We don't normally have lawyers from Legislative Council's office up here before the committee, but several months ago, I went to a meeting that Andy Olson asked me to go concerning the placement of the facility in Albany. And I came away, I did some research, and I realized that this was a very complex legal question because it's not just state law, but it's also federal law as it relates to the Federal Fair Housing Act and HIPAA and other issues like that. And I thought that when we ended this topic, it would be good to get a understanding of the legal issues here, both as it relates to guilty but for insanity and the interplay of federal law and sometimes the superseding of federal law over state law.
We're running a little behind our time, and it was our hope to wind this up in about an hour after this topic began, which is about 10 minutes from now, so I don't know, that may have compressed your time from what you were planning, but and that's not a drop-dead time, but if we could be mindful of the time and allocate your time appropriately, that would be helpful.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Nasby. I'm a deputy with Legislative Council's office. I was asked to kind of describe the I'm going to use acronyms too, by the way, PSRB for Psychiatric Security Review Board and GEI for Guilty Except for Insanity. And so I was asked to kind of give you a description of that process. I want to do one other thing preliminarily, and that is to explain that there are two classes of persons who can either be committed to the state hospital or required to obtain treatment in the community that are not under the PSRB's jurisdiction. On the civil side, there are civil commitment statutes in which persons can be committed to a state hospital or required to have treatment. And that's wholly divorced from any criminal act or the criminal justice system. And then on the criminal justice side, there are persons who have been found unfit for trial. And so those persons can be committed to the state hospital under a treat until fit order. And I won't get into all the details because of the time, but short version is they can be committed or required to undergo treatment, and they are not under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. Two things I think that are worth noting about the incapacity for trial. Number one, the focus is on the time of trial as opposed to the time of the offense. And number two, it's a precondition for being found guilty except for insanity. If you're not fit for trial, you wouldn't get to the GEI phase. So that being said, the GEI process starts like any other criminal action with alleged criminal conduct. Persons arraigned either appointed a lawyer or retained counsel. Lawyer will conduct a factual and legal investigation into the circumstances. We'll discuss with the client the potential upsides and downsides of a GEI plea. And then by statute, in order to introduce evidence of mental disease or defect, the defense attorney is required to file a notice. And what that notice does is it triggers a right in the state to have at least one mental examination of the defendant. And so just anecdotally, I would imagine that most of these cases that do go to trial involve kind of dueling experts, defense experts saying, yes, mental disease or defect, and state experts saying no. And then the jury is required to resolve that. So the test, I think, as Mr. O'Leary briefly mentioned, is whether, as a result of a mental disease or defect, the person lacks the substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of their conduct or conform their conduct to the requirements of law. Historically, those are evolved from what's generically called a right or wrong test and a volitional test. And so, essentially, it's whether or not the mental disease or defect prohibited the person from realizing what they were doing was wrong, or in the language of the defense attorney is required to file a notice. And what that notice does is it triggers a right in the state to have at least one mental examination of the defendant. And so just anecdotally, I would imagine that most of these cases that do go to trial involve kind of dueling experts, defense experts saying, yes, mental disease or defect, and state experts saying no. And then the jury's required to resolve that. So the test, I think, as Mr. O'Leary briefly mentioned, is whether, as a result of a mental disease or defect, the person lacks the substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of their conduct or conform their conduct to the requirements of law. Historically, those are evolved from what's generically called a right or wrong test and a volitional test. And so, essentially, it's whether or not the mental disease or defect prohibited the person from realizing what they were doing was wrong, or in the language of our statutes, criminal. And then number two, whether or not they could control their behavior, kind of a thing. GEI is an affirmative defense, which means the burden is on the defendant to prove it by a preponderance of the evidence. Procedurally, how this works is state puts on their case, defense puts on their case in a trial. Jury then first determines whether or not the prosecution has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that's where the guilty and guilty except for insanity comes in. And I think that makes sense. If you think about it, a person with a mental illness, if they didn't commit an offense, they shouldn't be held accountable. So they're acquitted just like any other person. So jury first finds the defendant guilty, and then they consider whether or not the defendant has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that the test I mentioned, the mental disease or defect, is applicable. And the GEI finding really is, it's very unique in the sense that there's a guilty finding, but the person doesn't go to prison. And so the courts have characterized this as a finding that the person is criminally culpable, but not criminally responsible. So in effect, they've committed a crime, but they're treated differently as a result of their mental disease or defect. And kind of in the same vein, a GEI finding is in some cases at least considered a conviction. So for purposes of post-conviction relief, a person found GEI can avail themselves of those procedures. But for purposes of a recidivist statute like the public indecency statute, it's not a conviction in terms of a prior conviction that will elevate the penalty for that offense. So just by way of example, that it's a conviction in some cases but not others, it's a very unique kind of a concept. So, jury finds, or judge finds defendant guilty except for insanity, and then we get to what's called the dispositional phase, and the judge has to figure out what to do with this person in front of him who's been found GEI of an offense. And I should note that the defense applies to any crime, so it can be littering all the way up to murder. You can be found guilty except for insanity. Okay, and so at the time of disposition, if the person is no longer affected by mental disease or defect, or if so affected, does not present a substantial danger to others requiring treatment or care, the court's required to discharge the person. And so essentially that procedure is for the person who is cured prior to, in between the time of the offense and the dispositional phase. So it's a present assessment of the defendant's mental health. There's also for nonviolent misdemeanors, when a person is found guilty except for insanity of a nonviolent misdemeanor, the court has the authority to initiate civil commitment proceedings, which will again be on the civil side and not subject the person to the PSRB's jurisdiction. For felonies and violent misdemeanors, the court's required to commit the person to the jurisdiction of the PSRB if the person is affected by mental disease or defect and presents a substantial danger to others. The statute indicates that a mental disease or defect in remission counts. It's a still if it can become active and when active render the person a danger, it counts as a mental disease or defect under the statute. And so the judge will commit that class of persons to the jurisdiction of the PSRB. And then the court initially has to make a decision on whether the person should be committed to the state hospital or placed on conditional release. Conditional release is just that. It's a release from physical custody with conditions. The court can appoint any person or government agency to supervise the person found GEI. The supervisory person is going to provide treatment and care to the person and report to the PSRB on a monthly basis. I should back up and say that in order to conditionally release someone, there's a third finding that needs to be made, and that is that treatment and supervision are available in the community. So if it's not available, the person's required to go to the hospital. If the judge finds the person is affected by mental disease or defect and presents a substantial danger to others, requiring commitment to the state hospital, person's committed to the state hospital. And then at that point, jurisdiction transfers from the court to the PSRB for both persons on conditional release and persons in the state hospital. And the PSRB has the same options that the court does in terms of they can discharge a person, they can conditionally release them, or they can commit them to the state hospital. And the statutory scheme is set up to allow this kind of conditional release, back to the hospital, conditional release, discharge. So there's flexibility in terms of whether or not the conditions have changed. The PSRB makes this decision through an adversarial hearings process. Persons are entitled to appointed counsel, medical examinations. Notice is provided to the person's lawyer, the attorney general, the district attorney of the committing county, and the court or juvenile department that committed the person. And it's the attorney general that represents the state in these PSRB hearings unless the district attorney elects to represent the state. So the DA has the option to take the place of the AG at the hearings. The burden is a preponderance of the evidence, and it kind of depends on what kind of a hearing it is in terms of who bears that burden. So in a hearing to revoke conditional release, the state bears that burden. In the PSRB's periodic review hearings, every 2 years and 5 years, depending on the circumstances, the state bears that burden. The person's authorized to file a motion to be discharged, conditional released, or modify the conditions of conditional release every 6 months, and in those cases, when it's the person petitioning, burdens on the person to prove by preponderance of the evidence the standard whether they're, if they want to be on conditional release, it's that necessary care and supervision are available in the community, and the person does not present a substantial danger with care and treatment. Last couple of things, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I have kind of flown through this rather quickly, but I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. The Department of Human Services is responsible for committing the person, and when the PSRB requires as a condition of release a pre-release plan, it's the Department of Human Services who's required to create that plan, and DHS is authorized by statute to contract with any person or governmental agency to, or the county mental health director to supervise the person. And I think that's all I have, unless there are any questions. I'll be happy to answer those.
Why don't we hear from Ms. Freeman, and then we'll take questions of both of you.
Chairs Przanski and McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Lori Freeman. I'm a deputy legislative counsel, and I work in the area of human services. I was asked to come here today and talk about some of the overlay of federal laws over this citing process involving PSRB, people within the jurisdiction of PSRB. And sort of in the spirit of it, my main handout is in a very large font. And in keeping with the time restrictions here, I will fly right through it. The Americans with Disabilities Act, I think, is a very important aspect of this to remember, because the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the Olmstead case that it is a form of discrimination to segregate people with disabilities. And therefore, the state, in providing services, has an affirmative obligation under the ADA to place people in the community in the most integrated settings. The exception to that is if it would cause a fundamental alteration in the program. And the courts that have looked at this have found that there is a fundamental alteration if the relief sought if the state currently has a comprehensive, effectively working plan to place people with disabilities into the community. In one case, out of Washington, a district court case, Ark of Washington versus Braddock, the state had a waiver program similar to the one that Oregon has, that has community-based care as a component, and people with disabilities can be placed in the community rather than in nursing homes. And the court found that they had a comprehensive, effectively working plan because the state had repeatedly applied for an increase in the size of the waiver. State expenditures for integrated community-based treatment had consistently increased, and the state's institutionalized population had decreased by 20% over 4 years. In another case, the court found that there was no comprehensive, effectively working plan where, in a similar community-based waiver program, the state had put a cap, an income cap, on who could qualify for the services. Therefore, there were some Medicaid-eligible people who couldn't even qualify. And in that case, the court struck it down under the ADA. And now the Fair Housing Act, the original Fair Housing Act protected people from discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, and natural origin. In 1988, the Fair Housing Act amendments of 1988 added disability to a basis for discrimination. And the courts have interpreted those amendments to establish a right of persons with disabilities to choose where to live. And this is to allow people with disabilities to be integrated to the greatest extent possible into the mainstream community. The courts have found a right to residential placement without community interference, and this acknowledges that there are fears, general fears and distrust of people with disabilities, and the Fair Housing Act was intended to keep those community fears from blocking the access of people with disabilities to living in mainstream communities. Courts have found that the Fair Housing Act creates a right to be free from restrictions that are not imposed equally on other groups of people living together. So in most of these cases, it's a zoning regulation. If it's applied only to group homes of people with disabilities, but it's not applied to other groups of families living in the community, and the courts have struck it down. An exception there is if the regulation is actually for the benefit of the people in the housing. For example, in one case, there was a regulation that required a community advisory committee to be established. That case was remanded by the district court to determine whether or not the community advisory committee's purpose was to sort of block the siting of the group home, or whether it was to facilitate the integration of those people into the community. But most importantly, the Fair Housing Act and the line of cases have said that regulations limiting the siting of group homes cannot be based on stereotypes or assumptions about people with disabilities. And finally, I wanted to put out one exception. There is a statutory exception under the Fair Housing Act if an individual's tenancy would create a direct threat to the safety or health of individuals in the community. But the courts, again, have been very clear that this has to be an individualized determination. In other words, you cannot use an assumption that everyone with a mental disability is a risk to the community. You must have specialized, specific information about a particular individual in the group home. And so under the Fair Housing Act, courts have struck down laws that require notification to neighbors of the siting of a group home, and laws which create minimum spacing requirements between group homes. And finally, I just wanted to bring up the privacy laws, because I think they play some role in the extent to which notification goes out to the community or law enforcement, and that is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which protects protected health information. And in this case, it would be DHS, possibly the PSRB, and the owners of the group home would be prohibited from disclosing any protected health information about the people living in the group home. And there are specific exceptions under HIPAA for notification to law enforcement, and I've listed them in the materials, but they all have to do with in the investigation of the commission of a crime or an immediate threat of a crime. And then finally, there is a state law, ORS 179.505, which also pertains to people who have been institutionalized in particular, and protects from disclosure any information about them that would identify them or that would relate to their past, present, or future mental health condition. And the exceptions to this, of course, are if there's a written authorization from the individual or if the information is being shared for the purposes of diagnosis or treatment. Thank you.
And I'm going to kick off the questions. Ms. Freeman, it strikes me that people who are being found guilty except for insanity might be a different category of risk to the public than people who are in group homes generally, even ones who have some criminal history. Were any of the cases under the ADA and the Housing Act, did they involve people who were being placed in resident community-based facilities who had that characteristic, that is, were been found guilty except for insanity?
Chair McPherson, there is a case out of New Jersey called In the Matter of J.W., and if you'd like the site, I can give you. I have it right here. In which they did challenge, in particular, restrictions, zoning restrictions, on housing that was for people who are guilty except for insanity. And in that case, just as in the other fair housing case, the court struck it down as being violative of both of the Fair Housing Act. And, I mean, there's an interplay here between the ADA and the Fair Housing Act in that they sort of use the same definition of disability. And, in fact, there's also some overlay with Title 8, or Title 7, I'm sorry. There's a U.S. Supreme Court case, School Board of Nassau County, Florida, versus Arlene, 480 U.S. 273. And this was a Title VII case in which a school teacher had tuberculosis, and she was fired for that. And it was overturned on the basis of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. And in that case, the court said, the fact that some persons who have contagious diseases may pose a serious health threat to others under certain circumstances does not justify excluding from the coverage of the Act all persons with actual or perceived contagious diseases. Such exclusion would mean that those accused of being contagious would be vulnerable to discrimination on the basis of mythology, precisely the type of injury Congress sought to prevent. And in the Matter of CW case, oh, here's the site, 288 New Jersey Superior 197. They relied on this finding in the School Board of Nassau case to say that the protections of the Civil Rights Act, be it Title VII, Title VI, ADA, they all require that you have an individualized assessment. And so even in the case of guilty except for insanity, where there may be a public perception that those people are more likely to reoffend or that they may be a danger, that it's important for the courts to uphold the idea that there has to be an individualized determination, so that even in a GEI case, there has to be an individualized determination before they can put any restrictions on the placement of that person or the siting of the group home.
Any further questions for either of the witnesses?
You mentioned individualized determination. My assumption is that before someone's released back into the community, the PSRB board has had a hearing and has made a determination, haven't they? That they do not present a risk to the community?
Chair Skrzanski and McPherson, yes, that is correct. And I think that determination that they can be safely in the community and receive their treatment and care there, I think that would mean that you almost prima facie would not have a case for arguing that they're a danger to the community.
Mr. Chair, if I may, thank you. But aren't those determinations made based on a level of security that would be, in other words, there are different people who are released back into the community based on certain security and supervision requirements, thus they're not ruled a danger to public safety. Would that be accurate? In other words, there's just not one level of determination this person's not a threat, so we go put them in a house.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that is correct. There is determination, but like in all of these community-based placements, there's a determination made of what is the most integrated setting that we can provide. And in the case of the GEI folks, the PSRB people, there's been a determination that whatever the setting is, that that's the most integrated while still maintaining the community safety.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Ms. Freeman, in regard to the statement that the determination is made by the PSRB, a recommendation is brought to them by a panel of reviewers of a specific case file, makes a recommendation to the board. How do you, would you account for, let's say, the scenario where a patient's record that would have indication that a provider for a patient has noted on medical records that that individual is a threat not only to self but to community, but that information was not brought forward to the review board to present to the PSRB. How then would you reconcile that consideration?
Mr. Chairs, Representative Flores, I can't. I don't know enough about the facts of the case, but it sounds like that's a breakdown in the system, and not, if the system was working properly, then all the relevant information at least would be before the board. They would make that determination. But the other thing is, Mr. Nasby is the expert here, not me, so I'm probably saying all kinds of wrong things, but my understanding is these are secure facilities, and so there would be a level of security there that would keep them from being free to get out into the community where they might cause harm if that indeed is at risk. But again, I think it gets back to this individualized determination and the idea that while they're on conditional release, their mental state deteriorates or they do something wrong, that can always be revoked and they can be sent back to the state hospital. So my understanding is that there's a continuing level of supervision over these people, and even though the board initially may not have been aware of some relevant fact, presumably that would become apparent as the person was out in the community.
Quick follow-up comment, thank you. While the specifics are obviously not available, but those are actual issues that have arisen. Secondly, if a person under a secure residential treatment facility overview, the staff training, when they go on their walkabouts in a neighborhood or community, would prohibit someone who is supposed to be residentially secure out in the neighborhood on a walk. The training for the staff does not allow them to subdue if somebody were to have a breakout issue. So I would agree with your earlier and first comment that there's a problem with the system, that maybe we need to take a little closer look.
If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse these witnesses, thank you very much for your presentation.
Mr. Chair, I just want to, for the committees, I think the best approach at this point is we have the work group, let's let the work group do what they're going to do, we'll have them back with whatever recommendations they have, and then we can look at whatever type of legislation that we may want to entertain for the 09 session.
We have then one remaining topic on our informational meeting, which is reentry of juvenile offenders back into the community. I'd like to invite Lisa Smith and Linda Wagner from Lane County Youth Services forward. Lisa and Linda.
Yes. It'll take us just a second to get set up.
Yeah, that's just fine. And while you're coming forward and getting set up, just to alert the committee to timing, we will conclude the morning meeting no later than 11:45 because we need a sufficient lunch break before the afternoon meeting back in the same room of a task force that a number of members here are involved in. So we will be holding this to 11:45 sharp.
This is something that's here. wife's principal.
Jeff, what are you going to do at noon?
Yeah, I can't tell you. I don't know if we carry it well enough, but what I just said, you know, if we have any interest,
I can't. I feel like we're going back about
3,500.
I was sitting there just waiting for me all day.
Chair Przanski, Chair McPherson, committee members, I want to thank you for the opportunity. I'm Lisa Smith. I'm director of the Lane County Department of Youth Services. And with me is Linda Wagner, the researcher and evaluator for the Lane County Department of Youth Services. We're here basically as a follow-up on your earlier meeting regarding reentry issues, and basically representing county juvenile departments and some of the unique issues facing juveniles reentering into the community. As you heard in the previous hearing on reentry, the issues for offenders reentering the community are both critical and complex. And this is especially true for the juvenile offenders, particularly from state facilities, local detention, and some of the more secure residential facilities. As Department of Corrections Director Max Williams previously explained, some of the issues facing adult offenders returning to the community, such as securing a driver's license, housing, jobs, treatment, are very difficult after you've spent any time in a facility. The juvenile reentry issues are very similar, but they're even more complex. And all 36... particularly from state facilities, local detention, and some of the more secure residential facilities. As Department of Corrections Director Max Williams previously explained, some of the issues facing adult offenders returning to the community, such as securing a driver's license, housing, jobs, treatment, are very difficult after you've spent any time in a facility. The juvenile reentry issues are very similar, but they're even more complex. And all 36 juvenile departments are providing some form of reentry service in varying degrees. But if you can imagine a youth committed to the Oregon Youth Authority at the age of 15 that's released at the age of 18, his reentry issues aren't just getting a driver's license, it's getting that very first driver's license, and in fact learning how to drive a car. It's not just getting a job, it's getting their very first job. It's trying to navigate all of the adult issues about deposits, security, credit, all of those things, when your entire existence has been in a secure facility. It's very difficult. The county juvenile departments play a very vital role in the reentry. We share our programs. We share some of our partnerships in the community with all these kids coming back. Also, we participate in a very strong way in the evidence-based practice implementation for the system. And I'm going to pass it on to Linda Wagner to show some of the Lane County local research and some of the county research throughout the state regarding reentry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I very much appreciate time on your agenda this morning. Thank you. Do I understand correctly, Mr. Chair? We have till 11:45.
Yes, we're including any question time. So if you could just keep that in mind.
Thank you, sir. I'll my personal challenge of brevity I'll rise to and try not to make it sound like the Evelyn Wood research information and still get to the main points. So the main points are we're tracking the effectiveness of our services in Lane County, both at looking at our impact on reoffenses and are we being good stewards of the public funds by looking at cost avoidance. And I'm going to give you an example this morning of what that looks like overall and how it applies to a program that works with youth who are coming back from out-of-home placements. And not wanting to be completely Lane-centric with you all, I also have some data from other counties and statewide information. So, boom, that's what I'm going to walk through with you. Thank you again for the time. The logic behind it is we have principles of effective practices, again, based on the work from Dr. Ed LaTesta and the University of Cincinnati. And the thinking is, with those in place, the balance of corrections and effective treatment, what's our accountability? How effectively are we providing those best practices services? And we have a quality assurance plan to monitor that. And if that's in place at the extent it should be, then what's the so what? What's the impact on changing in risk and resiliency with kids, the number of reoffenses, and the cost avoided? And those last two I'm going to highlight with you all this morning. We look at recidivism or reoffenses at three levels, and that's system-wide. It basically answers the question of all juveniles referred to the juvenile department in Lane County, how many come back and how often? And we apply that for all youth, and based on race, ethnicity, based on gender, based on age, based on type of offense, so we cut it down in subgroups. And then what does it look like for the different decision points? For youth managed outside the court, community-based services, how effective is it? For youth who are placed on formal accountability agreements, working with juvenile counselors, not under the jurisdiction of the court, but under our supervision. What does reoffenses look like for youth on probation and on those placed on out-of-home placements? And then with each one of those decision points are programs. So it's system-wide at decision points and at the program level, what's our effectiveness? And to give you an example of that, what I'm going to do is run through at the system level. But please keep in mind, we do these same kinds of analyses at every type of cut in the system, department-wide decision and program. So, for example, at the system, we asked in 04 how many juvenile offenders committed a criminal offense. And we have a standardized definition of juvenile reoffenses that is consistently applied to every program. So, and it's statewide. So it looks at all criminal referrals to the juvenile department, not violations. So we asked in 04, for example, how many juveniles had a criminal referral, and that made them eligible for the study, and then followed them for a subsequent 12 months. And what we found was 72% did not reoffend at all. Of the 1,400 individuals tracked, 1,082 did not reoffend. And then you can see down there that 6% had three or more new referrals. That's the chronic group that you hear so much about. The 94 youth with 424 referrals. I know this is 04 data, and we have more recent data, obviously 06, that we can track for a whole year, but I went back to 04 to show you what it looks like after 3 years of tracking, because a year isn't enough follow-up time with these young offenders. Just so you know, though, with 06 data looks very similar. 70% do not reoffend, and about 6% become chronic. So we do this every year. But if you take that same group in 04 and track them for 36 months, same group of kids, 1,484 individuals, tracked at 12, 24, and 36 months, and controlling for age so they don't age out of the system. I can talk to you about that if you'd like more information. So what we saw was at the 12 months, 72% did not reoffend. When you track them for 36 months, it drops to 60. And on the other end, that 6% who became chronic after 12 months really is more like 15%, which challenges some thinking in juvenile justice. One of those thinkings is that if kids are going to reoffend, they redo it right away. Not necessarily. That chronic group might not show up for 2 and 3 years. So the longer-term studies are really important. keep up with my notes. I'm going to show you exactly, I'm going to focus on the chronic group, but I'm going to show you exactly what those youth did, and then I'll drive home the point on why this is so critical in our determining services and targeting and how we are accountable for tracking our impact over time. The 1487 individuals, what it was at 36, tracking them, 895, 60% had 0% in new offenses. 374 kids, 25%, went on to commit 31% in new offenses for this group. And 218 individuals, or 15%, went on to commit 68% of all new offenses for that group. Very, very active. And we see this both in Lane County and other counties. It's a reoccurring theme, a smaller group committing a majority of the crime, that chronic group. I'm going to focus just on the chronic group for a minute and show you what this looks like over time. What we did was we went back to 97 and tracked that group of juvenile offenders, again, with a criminal offense. I'm not talking about runaway status offenses. We do that separately. But with a criminal offense, and said how many more criminal offenses did they have for 36 months and how many became chronic. So in 97, out of the 2,100 individuals, 20% became chronic. By 04, what you just saw, that 14%, 0.7% became chronic, a reduction in the chronic group. And when I present this to our budget committee in Lane County, sometimes I get some, so what, they're not really impressed. It's like, Linda, it's 5 percentage points. You put a lot of effort in. There's a lot of money. There's, you know, what is the so what about reducing it by 5 percentage points? And the way I answer that question is it's very significant. As a matter of fact, in 97, if in 97, we had had the same success as we did in 04, or in other words, instead of 20%, only 14% of the individuals in 97 became chronic, there would have been 1,000 fewer crimes in Lane County that year.
For juveniles.
For juveniles. This is all juvenile related. Yes, sir. And that's just for 1 year in one county. Imagine each year had we made some incremental change in that chronic group. Those 1,000 individuals would have related to a cost avoidance of approximately $5 million. Not cost savings, because money isn't put somewhere in the bank, but avoiding, because the number of referrals was reduced. And the reason that's so significant is because that group is so busy. Because you have that smaller group committing so many crimes, you successfully intervene with even a subgroup of them, and you have significant fewer victimizations by juveniles in the community. And as I said, it was although I've done this specifically for Lane for the last 20 years now in tracking recidivism and program evaluations, I have worked with other counties and statewide to look at data. And just to give you an example of what that means outside of Lane County, I looked at another county in southern Oregon that had 533 individual juvenile offenders. And their chronic group in 97 was 10% of the juvenile of those 533. In 04, it was 6%. So if 97 had experienced the 04 rate, they would have had 139 fewer offenses in 97, which doesn't sound like a lot, but you're only starting out with 533 kids, so it is very significant. And their cost avoided would have been $1.4 million. When I look at an eastern Oregon county of 145 individuals, 96 chronic group was 13%. They reduced it to 8, almost 9%, and that would have been fewer offenses for cost avoided, about $590,000 for that community. Done this in Lane, in several, almost all now, of the Oregon counties. We're all very representative of Oregon and of the nation. This started in California with the 8% problem, actually, where they were able to identify that chronic group. This is similar all around the nation. As a matter of fact, in any community, I will go in and say, I'll show you what your data will look like. It looks like this. It looks like in the blue box, you see the 0 to 9 age group and the 10 to 17 age group in the general community. The green box over here represents juvenile offenders, typically anywhere from 4 to 9% of this 10 to 17 age group become commit a crime, go to the juvenile department. And of the juvenile department, in that green column, about anywhere from 4 to 24%, depending on where you are, become chronic juvenile offenders. And the effect of three-pronged questions to us: how do you reduce folks in the kids in the blue group from ever committing that first crime, right, in good prevention? And there's ways to do that along the entire continuum. But for those who do commit a crime, how do you hold them accountable and then identify those most likely to end up in the chronic and break up that trajectory so that chronic group becomes smaller, reducing victimization? And for kids who make it to the chronic group, how do you successfully work with them so they don't go on to the adult system? We crack that code, and you have significantly started to turn the tide on juvenile crime. And as the data shows, it is possible when doing the right thing. And some of the ways that we've looked at in terms of best practices, I'll talk a little bit about how that is applied in Lane County and to reentry programs. How do we get from the 20 to the 14 with the chronic group? I know I'm hurrying because I'm this time conscious, but I do want to check in, Mr. Chair, for just a minute, make sure my pace is okay for the committee. Thank you. I'm sure you'd let me know, but I just needed that check-in. Thank you, sir. So in the way we're applying the evidence-based practices in Lane County is really basic. We, as everywhere else, and I believe the adult system pretty much mirrors the same approach, because what works there works with the kids too, is we want to identify the right youth, provide the right response at the right time. And the way we do that in Lane, in looking at the who, is we use a risk assessment tool, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Risk Assessment Tool, that's been validated twice now, that helps us to identify, when they come into the system, who's most likely to end up in that red chronic group. And by validated, I mean for youth with a score of 14 or more, they have an 80% probability that they're going to commit another crime in the next 12 months. If they have a score of 18 or more, we need to buckle up. There'll be very high rates of those youth go into the chronic group. So we identify who, and we want to make sure that our responses doesn't mix low, medium, and high-risk kids. Because if you move a low-risk kid with a high, you increase the probability that they become high-risk. So we're identifying the right youth and then doing the right thing, addressing what we use in Lane County, is looking at their criminogenic factors, what place them at increased risk of chronic delinquency, their beliefs, behaviors, attitudes, negative peers, family management, school problems, AOD problems, and provide treatment that addresses those while holding them accountable. We, of course, mix the corrections and treatment in a balanced approach. If you just do treatment, we're doing harm. If we just do corrections, we're not addressing the factors. So it's a balanced approach. We have to do both. But while they're in detention, they're getting services that address these, for example. That's a good example of a combination of the two. And the cognitive behavioral, of course, looking at that flow between their criminogenic thinking, behaviors, interrupting that, and giving them new skills. So when they go back into the community, they're more able to have the behaviors to be successful and productive. The treatment is matched to their learning style and the integrity. We have a lot of, there's all this theory and thought and 40 years of research, and we don't want to take that and morph it so much that we've changed it away from the things that made it effective in the first place. So we use a lot of check and balances along the way to make sure we're implementing it with a lot of fidelity to the model. That shows you recidivism at the system level. How we got there and looking at and really using best practices systemically. This isn't a single program. We do it from intake, probation, detention, community service. So it's a systemic approach. And then we say, well, this is how it affects our department and the community. What does it look like at the program level? These programs that are in the different decision points. And specifically, with you this morning, what does that look like for a program that serves juvenile offenders who are coming back to the community from lockup treatment of some kind of residential or detention OIA services, our own local community-based residential treatment. They're going into a program called the Martin Luther King Educational Center that provides those elements of best practices also. And we want to know how effective a single program is. And so what we do is we look at placement in the program and their average crimes before and after as a group. 2 years before and after, 3 years before and after, and what was the rate of change. This information is only as good as the comparison group we use. I think people come in and say, oh, kids, youth or adults went into a program, they came out, recidivism dropped 20, 40, 60%, and it sounds wonderful, really impressive, and indeed it is. It didn't become more chronic, and we saw that through the path anyway. But you can't say it's because of the program and the best use of those funds without a good comparison group. And the Juvenile Justice Information System, JAGIS, the statewide information system, allows us to do a great matching of similar kinds of kids who didn't get this particular treatment. So we have that, again, the stronger fidelity to this. In this particular program, MLK, it was reduced by about 60%. And the way that looks, and there's a lot of details behind all of this that I know I will not have time to go into today, because that's much more than Evelyn would. It's a whole hour. Sometimes people talk to me for 5 hours about it. So, but just in this moment with you, I will give you the highlights of it, and I'm more than welcome to come back with more information should that be the committee's desire. So we looked at 125 juveniles who went through the program. Cost per youth is about $2,700 per juvenile offender. And I always use another kind of beacon on that when you look at the cost per youth, because we talk about how expensive programs are for very high-risk youth. And these are indeed kids who have failed in every educational center, have been in out-of-home placement, have multiple criminal referrals, multiple failures, multiple victims in the community by the time they get here. For a cost of $2,700, I always compare that to a good mentoring program, which are wonderful and highly support them, that doesn't work with juvenile offenders, is about $1,800 per youth. So just as a comparison there. The crime reduction was 59% for this group of youth 2 years after the program. Cost avoided of about $2.5 million or about $20,000 per youth because of that level of reduction in crime. And I've been doing this with so many different programs that I know for high-risk youth, a cost avoidance, a reduction, a reduction in reoffenses between 58 and 68% is pretty typical if you have the elements of best practices in place and are doing it strongly with enough of the resources to support the infrastructure to provide it properly. Cost avoided, you typically see anywhere from $17,000 to $22,000 per youth. If anything falls really short of that, I know it's off. And if anything comes in really high, I wonder what happened to the data. So I go back and check it again and again, because that range is pretty typical. In looking at using what we know and achieving that reduction, even 5 percentage point with the chronic group has some very significant impacts on the community. When we look at that cost avoided, and I know Oregon is having met around the country with other researchers who are doing this kind of work, Oregon is definitely in the lead of best practices statewide and now putting a cost-benefit analysis on that. Cost benefits are much harder to find good ones nationally. When we started doing this in 1990, there was almost none. And I'm a juvenile justice researcher, not an economist. So I met with economists at the U of O to put together a logic that we could at least stand behind with a certain level of confidence in using it consistently in our evaluations. And we looked at the cost for victims, the juvenile justice system, law enforcement, prosecution, court costs, and came up with a cost per referral. And then if, as you saw, those before and after referral rates, if that goes up, the associated cost with that does, even though it's a fixed proxy, it's the way it's applied to the equation. Referrals go down, the cost avoided is applied. I will say that the cost of juvenile corrections was rather easy
to collect for a county because it was our department cost. Fully loaded. M&S, utilities, staff, everything. Law enforcement worked with the Public Safety Coordinating Council and looked at what Lane County's expenditures for law enforcement in the county were. We knew that juveniles represented about 18% of that, so we took 18%. This is just really simple logic we applied. At this time, there wasn't more sophisticated analysis like you see out of the Washington Policy Institute. Defense, same thing. We looked at the total cost and took out the juvenile portion. The cost to victims was the most humbling part of this for me in working in isolation. There wasn't a lot of good studies out at that time. I found a couple national studies on the cost of crime for victims and chose at that time not to include the cost for a murder. I really felt like I would need a lot more input and conversations with different groups, especially victims groups, to put a price on something in my view is priceless, and not I just felt like it was just more than my moment in research that I felt able to take on. So I did not include the cost for a lost life. I'm not in the position to do that. That would take a different kind of analysis with other people and a sensitivity to that and the reverence it deserves. So it does not include that, but all other costs for victims, property losses, time from work, insurance is calculated at a national level in cost of victims. All of those were put together and came up with an average cost per juvenile offense. It's very conservative. And then every year since 1990, I applied inflationary rates, so it's consistently applied. The thinking behind using a good cost analysis is that you can explain it, you have a rationale for it, and you apply it evenly all the time. It doesn't change for one person's program or another, and we've held to that model over the 18 years that I've been doing this, almost 20 years now. I started when I was 15, but no, I'm just kidding. For a long time now, but I know the models and research around cost-benefit is much more sophisticated now, and we're able to put something together that I think will take this to a whole new level, and I'm excited to work with the state folks who are working on that. Lane County will only benefit from that. But until that feels solid and ready to move forward, we're staying with this piece that we've put together over the years. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
So the program that Linda referred to, the Martin Luther King Education Center, that is the reentry program that we are using in Lane County. And the quote, necessity is the mother of invention. Well, certainly the fiscal crisis of 2003 created some invention there. The Martin Luther King Education Center originally started out as a traditional court school model. But because when the Oregon Youth Authority closed 250 beds and we had a number of kids coming back to the community, we also had kids coming out of some secure residential placements, we needed a way, an effective way, to deal with these kids that we weren't anticipating coming back, but were. And we also needed a good way to keep a handle on community safety with these kids that are obviously part of that chronic group and are so very busy. The Martin Luther King Education Center combines, well, it's a partnership between Lane Department of Youth Services, Oregon Youth Authority, Lane Community College, Lane Education Service District, Lane Workforce Partnership, and a number of local businesses. And we've designed a comprehensive model that provides traditional and special education services, GED services, vocational assessment, job skills programs. There are a couple of particular programs, culinary arts, landscaping, and veterinary technician programs that we have right there on site. And then we also have a number of internship and job placement opportunities for the kids. And what that does is, okay, we're able to get more restitution quickly to victims. We're able to get kids into meaningful jobs. We're able to increase their graduation rate, and we're also able to provide anywhere from 4 to 12 hours of daily supervision to kids that normally would have been out in the community unaccounted for. And so what she's got up there about the $2.5 million cost avoided, that's certainly impressive given the high-risk chronic group of kids we're talking about. but some of the other milestones for this program are also pretty incredible. We have an 80% daily attendance rate in the school program. These are kids who have been suspended or expelled from their school of residence, and they're coming from all over Lane County, not just Eugene and Springfield. We have agreements with the school districts that we actually have school buses coming there to bring kids for the program. We have waiting lists to get into the job training program. We have Starbucks that comes in and does our customer service training for kids that are going into the hospitality program. We have an agreement with some of the landscaping programs that we provide some of the native plants for some of their plantings. We also run the what's called the pro bono clinic, which provides veterinary care triage for folks who are homeless and have pets. And we do that with the local veterinarians. So the business community is very key in this. Those are the type of programs, when we talk about reentry for juveniles, those type of programs where they're getting that daily exposure to education and job experience along with their treatment, along with the other accountability measures that are so important, those are the type of things that we need to really be looking at in the future for reentry for youth. So thank you for your time, and we'd love to answer questions.
Very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just love to get your presentation sent to professional staff so that the Public Safety Strategies Task Force could also include that in its material. So if you could get that to Mr. Taylor, that would be great.
Glad to share. Thank you for suggesting.
Senator Flores.
Thank you, ladies. Are you familiar with the Multnomah County assessment report that Crime Victims United had done, and it was released the end of last month? And do you have any comments about that report?
Well, I'm not as intimately familiar with the situation there. I'm familiar with the report. We do use a risk instrument to determine service placement. We don't use the RAE in particular, but there's a wide array of services, but the human behavior is still not a perfect science. So even with the kids here, we have a 59% crime reduction. We don't have 100% crime reduction. So there's still more work that needs to be done, but ultimately when kids do walk out the facility, their behaviors do, there is a certain lack of control after that. We do, we're providing additional 4 to 10 to 12 hours of supervision for these kids and activities to hopefully keep them involved. We have in Lane County 32 beds of secure treatment for the entire county. So we're having to make release decisions many times during the day of who stays and who goes. There's a lot of finger crossing. We have capacity for 96 beds, but only operational funds for 32.
Go ahead.
Thank you. In regard to your effective practices and evidence-based research, are you using rigorous evaluation with random assignment? I've heard you talk about picking some numbers.
Yes, ma'am. What we do, because as I said, just looking at the program and putting impact statements on it really isn't sufficient. You need a good comparison group. And we find that the best we can, given we're in the field with juvenile offenders. So some programs, it is feasible to do a random assignment to it, because the alternative, it's not that the other group doesn't get findings, and if the methodology is not strong, we let folks know that in the evaluation. The level of sophistication of the methodology comes out in the evaluation.
One of the challenges in your part of the state, of course, is the decline in federal TIMIF payments, which has made it difficult to deliver a lot of core services. To what extent is your funding picture different for these services in Lane County than it is in the counties that are less dependent on TIMIF money?
Well, up until 3 weeks ago, we believed we were going to lose 50% of our secure capacity, so going from 32 beds to 16 beds. Our county did dip into reserves in order to keep 1 year of funding for our secure capacity. the Martin Luther King Education Center, we have completely funded that with non-general fund money, so through federal grants. We are one of seven sites in the nation that was funded by the U.S. Department of Labor for a youth offender program. So we're fortunate in that, but certainly it is a grim picture for Lane County for the future. We are looking at losing the secure custody program, so more of your probation services and things like that are going to become more critical. But at the same time, you've also got all of your providers out in the community also receiving significant cuts. And I think that's true of all of the southern region counties, Jackson, Douglas, Josephine, Curry, Klamath, and Coons. They're looking at, if not significant reductions in detention capacity and secure treatment capacity, some of them are looking at eliminating their capacity.
Any further questions from these witnesses?
I want to thank you all for coming up and giving the presentation. And for the committees, we're planning on having our next meeting in September, and it appears it's going to be in Eugene, probably at the University of Oregon. We're not sure, more than likely at the law school. But with Lane County facility, I'm going to take the liberty and discussing these issues before with Lisa and Linda, that maybe if you want to have some type of walkthrough or some type of presentation there on site, we may be able to work that out depending on what the schedules are. It may not be a function of the committee as a whole, but it may be on a invited an invitation to all the members who want to go through it on a special one, not knowing what our time frame will be. But it's a wonderful facility. The MLK Education Center, I've had an opportunity to meet some of the kids that have gone through there. And it's just remarkable to see how energized and how focused they are to turning their lives around, and seeing them walk out and actually have job placements and being a part of the community. And so that might be something that we can look forward to if you're interested in doing so. Again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Council Taylor,
for those involved in the tort task force, we're in the same room at 150.
Very good. Well, that concludes our agenda for the House Interim Committee on Judiciary for June 19, 2008. House Committee is adjourned.
And the same for the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We'll also stand adjourned until our next meeting.